Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Lots to talk about. Writer Richard Eskow is going to be here talking about the M&I bank thing, the people actually rising up and using their dollars for change. And something the right is just losing their minds over. How dare those union thugs do what we've been saying to do for years? We're going to talk about that. Also, Pennsylvania State Representative Greg Vitale going to be here talking about the budget, stuff of shale. The Democrats are calling for a sane, rational drilling moratorium to say, hey, you know what, maybe we need to slow down a little bit, try and play a little catch-up, make sure that we're not being run over by an industry hell-bent on taking every bit of profit out of the ground, but not having to, contribute, if you will, to use a Tom Corbett frame. Also, Scott Schultz of the Wisconsin Farmers Union going to be here talking about Saturday's amazing event, Tractorcade, where you had all of these farmers, well over 100,000 people in Madison, Wisconsin, filling the streets. A bunch of tractors there. Farmers came out to have their voices heard. It was an amazing, amazing event. We're going to talk about that with him. And also Frank Snyder from the Secretary Treasurer of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO is going to talk about a couple of labor actions going on in the area, one in Reading with Huffman Industries, their people being kicked to the curb, locked out. Also, tomorrow, I understand, Pocono Medical Center, those workers are going to be taking to the streets to say, hey, you know what, we demand a little bit better wages, a little bit better hours, a little bit better conditions. Because that's, after all, what we're all, the reason we all go to work, to make a living, to have a reasonable standard of living, and, that's the reason we do what we do. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, go to the website, thericksmithshow.com. But on Saturday, just an amazing event, Tractorcade. All these, I wish I was there. And all day long, I was with the kids going, I wish we could be there. Because imagine that moment in history. I mean, the largest worker rally in my lifetime. Because as I'm told, it surpassed the weekend that we were there, which was an amazing event in and of itself. Just phenomenal. And Dennis Kucinich gave a speech in Madison recently where he said an economic democracy is a precondition of a political democracy. And that kind of stuck with me in his speech, because without having the ability to put food on your table, the ability to fend off need, the ability to fend off want, you can't possibly stand up for yourself in the political arena. And the right understands this. They understand that if they can crush unions, because this is what this is about. This is about crushing any dissent, any opposition, any voice that your enemy may have. And the Republicans see Democrats as enemies. I was listening to one of the extreme right shows today, and they talked about an unholy alliance. Wisconsin shows that there is an unholy alliance between Democrats and unions. And I would make the argument that the Democratic Party is the last place for unions. Republicans have made it quite clear that there are very few of them left in the party. Now, there are some, especially when you get down to the state level, but there are very few left on the national level who aren't bought and paid for by big business. And it's a which side of the equation are you on thing. We are such a polarized society. And it's a bipolar society. I understand, you know, having a whole bunch of different factions and that, but this is really, I talked to a Tea Party guy the other day. We're having breakfast. And he was perfectly okay with the fact that Scott Walker broke the rules. He was perfectly okay that, like thieves in the night, they rammed through a piece of legislation that was done in the wrong way. And took people's rights away. He was okay with that because of his disdain for unions. And as we talked, I said, well, you know what? Maybe you're right. Maybe when the Democrats take back over, and they will, the pendulum always swings back and forth. So there's going to be a time when Democrats control Wisconsin. There's going to be a time when Democrats control Congress again. It's going to happen. You know, they said after 2008 that the Republicans were never going to control anything for 100 years. And here we are a couple years later. Look where we are. So I said, you know, the next time Democrats take over, how about we simply propose a bill that outlaws bullets? We're not touching guns. We want everybody to have guns. Just no more bullets. What would you say to that? And we did it like thieves in the night. We rammed it down the road. Well, he goes, I wouldn't like that. I said, well, neither would I. At the end of the day, there's right and there's wrong. And what they did was wrong. And at the end of the conversation, got him to go, hey, you know what? I agree that they went about it the wrong way. I still hate unions, he said. But you're right. They went the wrong way, and that's probably wrong. And I'll never forget that. That's probably wrong. And, you know, I guess maybe it was just to placate me. Maybe it was just to make me go away. I'm not quite sure. But I wonder that about our Tea Party friends. If they look at what's going on with their Republican Party right now and the massive overreaching that's going on. This, we now have the gavel and we're going to control what we want. Because understand, they are working towards shutting down the federal government. That's what it seems that they want. Because there is no compromise on that side of the aisle. There's none. And I think, in a bizarre way, I feel sorry for John Boehner. Because he is really stuck with a bunch of people with their fingers in their ears and their heads up their rears. Because they want to hear nothing other than what they campaigned on. And what they don't realize is campaigning and governing are two very different things. They're very good at campaigning. This governing thing's a little harder. And, you know, they keep passing these three weeks, keep passing these short-term solutions because they don't have the ability to govern. And they don't want to be the one seen to be shutting things down because they don't want to get their hats handed to them again like they did the last time they forced a government shutdown. So it's going to be interesting to see how this moves itself down the road. The big moneyed special interests are out there, funding what they're supposed to be doing, saying the right words, and they're out in full force. I look on Friday. In the St. Louis Regional Chamber and Growth Association had an event, and they invited Tom Donahue, the president of the U.S. or the International Hit Squad Chamber of Commerce, and he gave this I guess he was going to give some presentation on the economy. And some reporter asked him, said, hey, you know, what do you think of these people out here who are protesting you and the event and all of this? And basically, you know, they're just a bunch of idiots. They don't know anything. They don't need, he goes, do you think they even know what a derivative is? And I'm sure most of the people don't. But I know they know it didn't do them any favors. And I know they know it didn't help them. They may not be able to explain every detail of it, but they knew that that's what brought this economy down. And the reporter went on to ask about what's going on in Wisconsin. And he said, you know, what do you think about what's going on in Wisconsin with Governor Walker and the hundreds of thousands of people who are in the streets? And interesting response. Company line. Public sector pensions, out of control. Public sector workers, overbloated. This is a guy who took $3.7 million last year. He chauffeured around in a limousine. He flies around in a jet. He is the sixth highest paid lobbyist in the country. And that person that makes sure my grandmother gets her Social Security check, that person that files our unemployment claims, that person who takes care of the old people in the nursing homes, that person who does all of those public sector jobs, they're somehow overbloated and out of control. Really? This from a guy who took $3.7 million from corporations to be their assassin? If you remember during the healthcare debate, this was a guy who corporate America funneled $87 million through. Oil companies, chemical companies, the defense industry, they just kept funneling him money. Why? Because he's doing their bidding. And you look at what's going on in Wisconsin. I think Walker is really, he's got to be second guessing what he did. This has sparked a movement in this country. A movement of people who the Tea Party wish they could be like. A movement of people that the Glenn Becks and all of the promoters of those schemes to get people's money wish they could be like. And, you know, it's not a bunch of angry people. You know, the Tea Party were a bunch of angry people who felt, you know, they're being ripped off. And all of their dreams were dashed. These are people who are saying, look, we've got a good solid middle class lifestyle. We'd like to keep it. And we'd like to bring the people up behind us and to help them. We want everybody in the middle class. And you know what's interesting? What's really interesting to me are the people that we met, the people that you saw in the streets. You know, it gave a face to unions, I think. It's not the dirty factory worker. It's not the uneducated guy who's working on an assembly line. It's not the guy swinging the hammer. These are well-educated, articulate people. Which is why I think you're seeing so many people looking at this going, you know what? Yep, I think union people are decent folks, which is why you've seen the polls so high. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Pennsylvania State Representative Greg Vitale. Stick around. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. On Wednesday, workers, their unions, and supporters of workers' rights will rally in Lansing, Michigan to protest attacks on worker rights. It's part of a national movement defending worker rights against the coordinated national attack on workers and unions. Michigan Republicans are pushing 40 anti-union, anti-worker bills through the legislature. The Michigan AFL-CIO is urging all workers, unions, and community supporters to turn out Wednesday to protest this attack in Lansing. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the mass workers' movement sparked in Wisconsin is an historic opportunity that must not be lost.
In your lifetime, have you ever seen this much solidarity? Have you ever seen this much excitement, this much activism? Let me say, as progressives, it's our job to transform the outrage and to make this moment a movement, to ensure that This corruption in the Midwest does not stand. And we have the immense responsibility to keep the fire lit, spark real change for America.
On April 6th, the federal court will hear a motion by National Football League players to order owners to lift the lockout of the players. Owners want to grab $1 billion more off the top of league revenue and force players to play more games. The AFL-CIO says it stands with the players, just as members of the Green Bay Packers stand with Wisconsin public workers in their fight over collective bargaining. Dennis Kucinich connects the anti-labor dots in the Midwestern states. Jesse Russell reports.
Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich was one of the speakers at what has become known as the largest rally in Wisconsin's history on Saturday. The congressman used the opportunity to connect the dots between the battles that are unfolding in Indiana, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Michigan.
In the past week, a bill has moved along that would strip the right of collective bargaining for Ohio's public workers, that would put them in harm's way should they decide to strike, because then replacement workers would come in and then would set the stage for privatization. And after all, isn't what this is all about?
Kucinich said the various pieces of legislation being proposed and passed in those states amount to a power grab by corporations who want to see the public sector privatized. He also referred to a portion of Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's budget repair bill that would sell off state power plants via a no-bid contract.
What they believe in is government of the corporations, by the corporations, for the corporations. That might work on Wall Street, but it's not going to work in Wisconsin. And it's not going to work in Ohio. And it's not going to work in Michigan.
This newscast made possible in part by the National Education Association and AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.com.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Penn Live's reporting that three people who were covered by the state-run health care plan for more than 41,000 low-income adults that Corbett ended a couple of weeks back, they've sought a court order to force the state to continue funding it. Evidently, the lawsuit filed in Commonwealth Court today names Governor Tom Corbett and top lawmakers, and the plaintiff's lawyer, Bill Caricelli, says the legislature and executive branch have no legal ability to end the program called Adult Basic, and we've been talking about that for some time. He says that there's still money there. It requires that a portion of the money from the tobacco settlement fund that, and he also says that allowing Adult Basic to end violates both the state constitution as well as the 2001 law that set aside the money for Adult Basic. But then again, you know, we'll see how this turns out, but the question is how many people will die in the interim or how much worse will they get. Anyway, last week, big news. The Democrats came out and said, you know what? We got to slow the drilling industry down. Let's take a step back. Let's take a look at it. And one of the guys leading that fight is Representative Greg Vitale. Greg, welcome to the program.
Hey, Rick, how you doing?
I'm good. I appreciate your time.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You know, I watched a good portion of the press conference you guys had, and you know, I've been calling for this for a while now because I think that the industry has gotten away from us. I think they're already out ahead of us. We need to somehow slow it down and play catch up.
You know, it's real disturbing, all of the campaign contributions they're giving. I think Governor Corbett got, you know, close to $1 million in the past 10 years. I know that other senators have gotten substantial sums of money. They're spending huge amounts of money in lobbying. I know that former Governor Ridge's firm got about a $900,000 contract from the Marcellus Coalition. And it's really disturbing because, you know, with that sort of thing out there, I mean, you know, people really wonder, you know, about when the governor says, no Marcellus drilling tax, you know, where's that coming from? And so people do have a right to be concerned, and you know, I've introduced a couple of bills relating to the Marcellus Shale issue. I'd be happy to talk to you about them.
Yeah, well, walk me through this. The idea, last week there was a press conference, and from what I gathered, The Democrats are saying, look, we'd like to slow this down, go back to what Governor Rendell had suggested, and go forward from that point.
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
Well, there's two separate issues. Well, there's a number of pieces of the Marcellus shale issue. The first, we had a press conference a couple of weeks back calling for a Marcellus drilling tax. We think it's in every major gas-producing state imposes a drilling tax on drillers. Drillers are making tons of money, and they ought to pay their fair share. We proposed it's House Bill 33. I was the prime sponsor of that, introduced it a number of weeks back. It imposes a very reasonable tax, about a 6% tax, on drillers for the gas they extract. And a third would go to the general fund. We desperately need the money, so we don't cut things like adult basic. A third would go to local municipalities who are impacted by the drilling, and a third would go to environmental programs to kind of help bring the environment back because it's being degraded by the drilling. So very reasonable proposal. The government in his budget address basically said, I'm not imposing a Marcellus drilling tax, which is bad policy. Now, the press conference you're probably referring to is another bill that I've introduced last week. It was House Bill 150. That would basically impose a three-year moratorium on leasing out any more state forest land for Marcellus drilling. And the reason why we're doing that is over the past couple of years, you know, leasing out our valuable state forest land has sort of become a cash cow. We've been balancing the budget by leasing off this valuable resource, and we've already leased about half of it. We've leased about 725,000 acres of our state forest land for drilling, and this is really nice stuff. And we have about 800,000 acres left. And what we're simply saying is just stop. Stop. Let's take a pause. Let's see the effect that all this drilling is going to have on the quality of the state forest. And then after a couple of years, you can sort of revisit the issue. But it's a very sort of reasonable, I think, approach to drilling. We're just saying slow down. We're not affecting the private land where most of the drilling occurs, and we're not, the bill doesn't affect the land already leased. But what's left, that 800,000 acres, let's hold on to that, because listen, that's enjoyed by all Pennsylvanians, hikers and fishers and, you know, horseback riders and campers and so forth. It's let's not just squeeze every last dollar out of it right now. Let's save it for future generations.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. You know, I look at your House Bill 33 and you say the 6% general tax. Yeah. During the budget speech, the governor said he would like Pennsylvania to be like Texas.
Well, yeah,
when I went to Texas's website, they have a drilling tax of 7.5%.
Right. I mean, Pennsylvania's, I think, like number 15 in gas production right now, and every state above it imposes some sort of drilling tax. These drillers, they have the money. Some of them have annual profits of in the billions, 7-8 billion a year. These are huge multinational companies like ExxonMobil and others. They can afford it. It's a cost of doing business. And you know what? They really impact an area. They really, you know, when they go into a local municipality, they chew up the roads and they stress the services, the water, even things like the court systems. I mean, they really need to sort of give back. They degrade the quality. And drilling is a very industrial activity. You know, it degrades the environment. They need to pay back. We need the money for the general fund. So, it's a very reasonable approach, and you wonder with all this tremendous budget problem we have with this $4 billion shortfall, what the heck is going on? You really do. I mean, he announced in that budget he's cutting basic ed by a billion dollars. He's cutting higher ed in with regard to some places in half. You know, you already talked about adult basic. I mean, all these cuts, and he's going to let the drilling industry skate. I mean, you know, come on, that just that sends the wrong message to Pennsylvania. I mean, what Governor Kubert says is that, well, I campaigned on this, the people elected me because of, this no tax pledge. You know, polling shows, there's a recent Pittsburgh poll that showed 63% of Pennsylvanians support this Marcellus drilling tax. So if he really wants to do what the people want him to do, he'll enact this drilling tax.
Yeah, but it's blind ideology. You know, and we're seeing this on the national level. You're seeing this across the country. You look at Wisconsin. Vast majority of people are in the favor of the union folks.
Yeah.
Yet you got a governor who's got his head in the sand saying, this is what I was elected on, even though he wasn't. It's that blind faith ideology.
And I think he has to realize this isn't a monarchy. You have the legislature, and you even have very powerful Senate Republicans. Governor Senator Pileggi, for example, he's the Senate Majority Leader. He has come out publicly in support of this drilling tax. So politics, it's the art of compromise, and he has his views.
Although it used to be the art of compromise. What we're seeing in Washington right now doesn't, and sadly some of the things I'm seeing here, doesn't see much compromise going on. Let me ask you this, Representative Vitale.
Sure.
As we talk about this drilling tax, I've made the argument that it's already in the business plan of these drillers. We're already paying it. We're just not benefiting from it. And I point to a state like Alaska, and this has been given a lot of mileage, but Alaska's no socialist state in the eyes of the public. But yet, every year, the oil industry hands out a check to every citizen saying, here is your natural resource tax back to you.
I think the gas drills are playing a delay game. I mean, the reality is that when you put a well in, you get half of the gas, over half the gas out in about the first 2 years. So the longer they can delay having to have this tax imposed, and perhaps at some level they do realize it's inevitable, the more money they will never have to pay. So I think they're playing a delay game. But as far as the citizens of Pennsylvania go, we already pay that tax because about 70% of the gas we import it comes from states that impose a severance tax. So we're the citizens of Pennsylvania, when we buy our natural gas, some of the money we're paying for that gas is going to all these other states that in fact do impose a severance tax. It's kind of interesting.
Isn't that nice of us?
Yeah. So there's really no real good policy reason not to do this. I mean, he says, it's a fledgling industry. You know, ExxonMobil, a fledgling industry? Come on.
Range Resources, I hear all day long, Range Resources, they're my drilling company.
Yeah.
Yeah, and all the wonderful stories, and you look at all the money that we're funding these ads. It's our money they're using to convince us that they're doing good for us by not contributing to the state.
And frankly, a lot of these companies, a lot of these big drilling companies, you know, the argument's made, well, they pay this tax and that tax and that tax. You know, 70%, according to the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center, 70% of these drilling companies are organized as either partnerships or LLCs, so that they're really not paying tax at the corporate level, but at the state 3% level, and even then they're depressing the income they're actually showing because they're getting all these federal breaks, all these production credits, and all these other federal benefits they've been able to secure in federal law. So really, when you look at what these companies are paying to Pennsylvania, it's not as much as you think. They don't pay any property tax on the gas that's in the ground. They don't pay sales tax on much of the equipment they get because there's some sort of production exemption. I mean, they really really aren't paying their fair share.
So here's the other question I have then, since you've made the statement that they're not paying, do they have a post office box in Delaware?
Yeah, I don't know. I honestly I honestly don't know. That's a good question.
Well, I mean, because if we're not only are we losing the money that we would have gotten had we imposed this drilling tax, but if the profits are going out of the state through the Delaware loophole, through the, you know, the P.O. box there where it's scrubbed and cleaned and pushed off to someone else, I'd like to know that too.
Yeah, good question. Well, I think people out there need to call their legislators. They gotta ask them, you know, how they voted. They ought to say, you know, were you a co-sponsor of the Marcellus drilling tax bill? And if not, why not? I mean, where do you stand on House Bill 150 and leasing state forest lands? I mean, that's you know. Legislators, I think we act out of fear sometimes. If we fear that, if we feel that our constituents are going to turn on us, that sometimes can counteract the corrupting influence you have with all the money that's going around. I mean, you know, our citizens can't flash to the Super Bowl like these drilling companies can, but they can vote us out of office. So I think people out there ought to just sort of, you know, take the time to call the legislator, their state senator, their state rep's office, and say, "Hey, listen, were you a co-sponsor on any of this legislation? I mean, what are you going to do here? Why not? What are you going to do to get your majority leader to run a bill? Okay, don't tell me you're for it. Are you going to get your majority leader to get this thing done? Yeah. I mean, so you know, people need to sort of get out there and just let their legislator know they're paying attention.
Absolutely. You know, not all of us can be like Scarnati and jump on a plane paid for by somebody else and see the Super Bowl on someone else's dime. You know, and again, what I'm hoping is that people are going to look at this and say, look, there's an awful lot of money that we're not getting, that the industry's taking at a time when we're talking about cutting, as you pointed out earlier, $1 billion from education, over 50% from higher education. We're talking about cutting programs for mental health. We're talking about cuts all down the line.
Yeah.
And the only people who benefit seem to be these big corporations. At some point, you got to say, if we're saying times are tough, we need to tighten our belts. Times are tough for everybody.
Absolutely.
Greg, I appreciate your time.
Greg, thanks for giving me the chance to chat with you anytime.
All righty, Greg Vitale.
Keep up the great work.
Thanks so much. State Representative, we're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show. The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
No doubt you will be as pleased as I was to learn that the Securities and Exchange Commission is cracking down on those unconscionable pay packages that Wall Street elites keep grabbing. By a 3-2 vote, SEC Commissioner socked the money-grubbing bankers with a new say-on-pay rule. Rather than let top executives lavish money on themselves unchecked, the new rule lets shareholders of these financial giants vote on extravagant salaries, bonuses, and perks. That'll rein in the excess, right? Probably not. You see, the SEC has long been a gentle regulator, never wanting to hear a Wall Streeter say, "Ouch." Thus, the say-on-pay rule has no bite. Shareholders can indeed have their say, but it's a non-binding vote. Bank big shots can simply ignore it. Yet, even this velvet harness was too rough for the two soft-on-greed Republican commissioners, Kathleen Casey and Troy Paradis. Both voted no, with Casey explaining that the new rules are, quote, unduly restrictive and impose unnecessary burdens on bankers. Don't despair, though, for justice still might be served. The SEC has since approved another compensation crackdown, this time specifically targeting outrageous multimillion-dollar bonuses. For the first time, big banks will henceforth be compelled to restrain themselves. How? By filing detailed annual reports about the bonuses they pay. Ouch, that'll sting, won't it? Again, though, even this tiny pinch was too harsh for the compassionate Republican members. Both sided with the poor bankers, wailing that requiring reports is a big government intrusion into the private sector, overreaching the SEC's authority. This is Jim Hightower saying, luckily, a group named Bankster USA is rallying grassroots support to curb banker greed. For real reform, contact BanksterUSA.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Every morning at the mine, you could see him arrive. He stood 6 foot six and weighed 245, kind of broad at the shoulder and narrow at the hip. And everybody knew you didn't give no lip to Big John.
Yes, I
Big John.
Yep, Big John. Big Bad John.
You know, I bet you Boehner's not feeling that big and bad right now. You know, because I do believe, you know, he had these grandiose ideas that he was going to be the next hammer. He was going to be the next Tom DeLay without the jail and the proctology exams. I'm sure he had that in, he had visions of the hammers dancing in his head when he took that oversized gavel to, you know, to meet his oversized ego with the spray on tan. You gotta love that. You gotta love somebody who's not ashamed to, you know, to spray paint himself. I love that. Anyway, the people over at the Too Much Online blog have an interesting number. The number? 66 billion. That's the amount House Republicans, those in the majority, want to cut from this year's non-security domestic programs. Everything from K through 12 education to clean water to medical research. That's according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And interestingly enough, it equals exactly what we gave away back in December. You remember when we gave those big tax cuts away to everybody making over $250,000? Remember that? $66 billion is exactly what we handed out. Doesn't it make you happy to know that we're going to be cutting education for children? That we're going to stop looking at our water to make sure it's clean, and we're going to stop funding medical research so that, you know, those folks who are doing real well, you know, the people making over $1 million a year are going to actually put another 130 grand in their pocket thanks to us. You know, at a time when they keep telling us, and I hear this all the time, oh, ad nauseum. I hear this all the time. Times are tough. Need to tighten our belt. Yes. Hold on. Here it comes. It's just like when you're at your kitchen table. Doesn't it drive you nuts? Somehow thinking that how you operate your household is how our government should operate. So that when you lose your job and you begin to prioritize, because you're going to have to cut back. You're going to get that unemployment. It's going to help a little bit. But you have to cut back. You're going to pay your rent. You're going to pay your electric bill. And maybe you'll cancel the cable, and maybe you'll cut back. You won't eat hamburger. You'll have store brand mac and cheese. But you cut back. If we do that on the governmental level, when things go south, it goes south for everyone, and it continues to go south because there's nothing to help buoy us up. So if I'm to understand that logic, because the economy is bad, we can't extend unemployment benefits because we don't have the money. We don't have the income coming in. There's no revenue. And if there's no revenue coming in, we can't help those people who are on unemployment. So basically, screw them. They're on their own. Does that make sense to you? So that when things get worse and the economy continues to get bad and you have people who are starving, taking to the streets, stealing from the grocery stores, we don't have police because the police have all been laid off because we don't have the money to pay them. And then we have no one to guard the jail, so we can't put them there because we don't have the money to pay them, remember? Although they always seem to find money to put people in jail, don't they? If you look at Corbett's budget, they found money. They found it by taking from children. They found it by taking from those who were least able to defend themselves. And isn't that what we've been telling you all along they would do? Because it's what they do. They're going to balance their budgets on the backs of those least able to defend themselves, those least able to shoulder the burden. And I go back to this, and we talked about it back in December when they rammed it through, and they called it compromise. Understand, we in order to help several million people who were on unemployment and needed that lifeline, we had to give billions of dollars away to the very affluent who don't need it, aren't going to use it to benefit our society, but we had to give them that as the pound of flesh. Explain to me the rationale. I wish someone could explain it to me because I'm not getting it. This idea that we give the wealthy all of this wealth, and somehow it's going to flow down upon us. It's going to trickle down. They're going to create jobs. It doesn't happen. Where they've created jobs in every study, every position paper I have seen has shown that, yeah, they create jobs in China, in India, in Brazil, Guatemala, everywhere but here. Why? Because there's a bigger return. They're going to find the biggest return. It's not so good for the country, but it's good for them. And this idea, and I hear this often, that we want to help the job creators. Got to help the job creators. So we give these big companies these huge tax breaks. And like here in the state of Pennsylvania, we're going to hand out $833 million in tax breaks at a time when we're talking about cutting $1 billion in education in the hopes that maybe, possibly, we hope that people will buy new machinery and upgrade. Here's the problem. They're going to buy that new machinery, probably. They're going to mechanize. And they're going to lay people off. They're going to do away with their human capital, and they're going to invest in physical machinery to do the jobs. We're seeing that in a place out in the West, that Horsehead place. They're gonna get some money. They're gonna upgrade, and it's good. Good, they're gonna upgrade. Good for them. It's gonna be good for the environment. It's gonna be good for the company. It's gonna be healthy. But at the end, they're gonna probably lay off half their employees. So explain to me how that tax break helped the taxpayers of the state of Pennsylvania, because I'm not getting it. And I wish someone could explain it to me because it isn't making an awful lot of sense. That we're going to give a whole bunch of future tax revenue back to these companies in the hope that they'll hire employees who will pay taxes to the state and then offset the losses. Somehow we're going to benefit from this. But you're talking about laying off half the workers. I'm just not getting it. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Another thing I came across, the 10 most shocking spending cuts that Republicans want to do right now. You know, in looking at what's going on in Japan, the fact that the Republicans want to strip $126 million from the National Weather Service kind of makes you go, yeah, is that a great idea? They're the agency within the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. What they're supposed to be doing, prepare us for tsunamis, for hurricanes, for blizzards, floods, all of that stuff. Keep us aware of what's going on. You know, over in Japan, they had a one-minute warning, and they're saying that probably could have saved, you know, hundreds of thousands of lives. They had a one-minute warning. The total, you know, it's the same agency that issued the warning on Friday for people on the West Coast after the nearly a 9.0 magnitude earthquake. The measure they want to cut, $454 million from NOAA. That's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They want to just cut that away. See, what else do they want to cut? They want to cut $120 million to the Strategic Petroleum Reserves. They want to get rid of the emergency oil reserve people. Yeah, you know what? Hey, we don't need to keep an eye on that. They want to cut $510 million for FEMA, grants for firefighters. So big cuts there. They want to do away with the $70 million for law enforcement wireless communications. Basically going to push that down to the states, and the states will then do what they do and push it down onto the local governments, or it's just not going to happen. They're going to cut, you got to love this, oversight for the financial markets. the Commodities Future Trading Commission. Their job is to oversee the derivative swaps. You know, the financial instruments that, you know, Tom Donahue said, those people aren't smart enough to understand. They want almost a $60 million cut for that. So, you know what, hey, just like Tom Corbett's budget, they cut $22 million from the insurance industry oversight. Same thing here. We don't need that oversight. Remember? These are the good guys. The banking people are the good guys. They also want to cut over $2 million for the prosecution of financial crimes. They're getting rid of the Treasury Department's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. They also are cutting $70 million for legal services that help women who suffer from domestic abuse. Nice cuts there. They're cutting $110 million from helping teens avoid unwanted pregnancies, doing away with that whole community grant for prevention. Again, because abstinence only in their mind, only thing that works. They're cutting $300 million in job programs that were targeted at young people, 16 to 19 years old, whose unemployment rate is almost 25%. And they also want to cut almost $800 million for USAID, the child survival and health care grants, you know, the stuff that you give to developing places like Africa, places around the world. So, hey, good times. Good times ahead. So, you know, we don't have to have a drilling tax. We don't have to close the Delaware loophole. We don't have to have corporations pay their fair share. We can just chop everybody else. Let's take a quick break, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Controversial, thought-provoking, opinionated. Smith.
Amy Morton, Executive Director of CAIU, on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of health care and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Our workers' comp system is a confusing maze of rules, delays, and loopholes where workers struggle to collect what they are owed. Bills don't get paid, and families struggle to put food on the table after a serious work injury. What happens when you're injured on the job in Pennsylvania? Most people think you just applied for workers' comp and you'll get paid for lost time and your medical bills will be covered. Sadly, in Pennsylvania, that is not the case. The good news is, it doesn't have to be that way. Hi, I'm Ron Calhoun, and I'm a Central Pennsylvania workers' compensation attorney. It's my job to make sure injured workers receive the benefits they deserve. In the last 20 years, I have helped hundreds of Pennsylvania workers and their families after they've suffered from a work injury. If you've been injured on the job, I'd like the chance to show you how I might be able to do the same for you. Why not find out what you are rightfully owed? Call me at 717-695-4722. You have nothing to lose and much to gain. Call me at 695-4722.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know?
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Progressive talk with a conscience.
Stephen King was speaking at a rally against the state budget down in Florida last week, and he said, you know what? He goes, I'm a rich guy. I pay 28% taxes. He says, what I want to ask you is, why am I not paying 50%? Why is everyone in my tax bracket not paying 50%? And I got to be honest, Stephen, I have no idea. I wish you were, and I'm sure you do too. Let's take a phone call. I got Gary on line one. How are we doing tonight, Gary?
Doing well, Rick. Good to hear from you. I listened to your laundry list of cuts that are being proposed, and I thought, you know, this Republican leopard really never changes its spots.
No.
If we remember not too many months ago, if many people think it was the efforts of on the Daily Show that the Republicans actually refused to pay for health care benefits for the first responders at 9/11. And on that show, there were six, I believe, gentlemen who put their lives on the line. And then the inevitability of it is they gave their lives for it, because probably by now each and every one of those men had succumbed to the illnesses that they received from that catastrophic event. But no matter what ended up happening, the Republicans were going to hold them, hold the benefits back for these men for whatever their reasons were. And people should stop and think for a moment. What kind of logic can you put to this? What kind of humanistic approach can you, what excuse can you possibly make that makes this sound government?
There is none, and they'll be quite honest with you. They don't believe in government. They want to destroy government. Look, and this is the position I took right from the beginning, especially when you're talking about the folks right after 9/11 who did heroic duty. If we're not going to take care of people that we call heroes, who's going to be there in the future when we need them? No one is going to step forward given what has happened in the past. At least I don't think so. And you look at right after 9/11, you had Bush who wrapped his arms around those people. Oh, yeah, we love you when there's a photo op, but we're not going to pay for you.
Yeah. I heard a wonderful definition of the firemen and the policemen is that while people ran from that location, these were people that were running into it.
Yep.
They put their lives aside for the safety and the benefits of those folks that were involved in that. And they didn't do what the fit package was. They didn't do it for any reason other than not necessarily their job. It was the human aspect that they felt the greater good was their fellow man. And I don't know. I'm hard pressed to think that there's a core group of legislators that we elect don't have that same value. And that really is unfortunate.
And the amazing thing is, and something you don't hear very often, is the good majority of them were union workers who were construction workers in the area that volunteered their time and were down there on that pile doing the work that to recover people.
That's correct. That's very correct.
And now you look at what the Republicans are trying to do to union members. Boy, back then it was, oh, we love you, thanks for being here. And now it's we're gonna try and kill you.
Yeah. Do you have a couple minutes?
Sure.
I had a friend of mine who works for a fiber optic company, and they were in New Jersey for a number of years. The company looked to farm out some of that business, and they went to Mexico. And they had put about 40% of their business was being done through companies in Mexico. As it worked out, I guess Mexican labor became too expensive. So they farmed that labor and those parts from Mexico to China.
Yep.
He had the opportunity to go to China, and we were discussing this trip that he had. He was there for about 4 or 5 days, and they toured through the plant that they were in, and they make these little connectors and different fiber optic connectors and associated products. And he went on to say that how this plant worked, and it worked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and there was absolutely never a stoppage in production. And they toured from a distance. They toured one of the, as he calls it, hotels that these folks lived in, and where they were incarcerated, which is probably a better description, yeah. And he actually came across by thinking what a great opportunity this was for business, and how these folks actually, how the Chinese people promote the philosophy of China. And I asked him straight out, do you think that they're promoting this at will? You think this is something they look forward to? leaving their families and working for 4 to 5 weeks at a time, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's the reason why you get these pieces made, for the pennies, for the half pennies on a dollar that you're getting paid for. And the topic of this conversation started by him saying unions have outpriced themselves in the market. And I said, you know what? In this country where minimum wage has become too high a price to pay for production and Mexican labor has become too high a price for labor, how can you even suggest that unions have priced themselves out of a market?
But people, they believe it because it's their ideology, Gary.
Yeah, you're right.
I appreciate the call, brother. Thank you so much.
My friend. Take care.
All righty. Let's go to line three. We got Ike on line three. How are we doing tonight, Ike?
Hey, how you doing, Rick?
I'm hanging in there, brother.
I heard that. Well, I got three things for you real quick. Number one, I called into Wisconsin, local show there, which is how I listen to you as well on my smartphone. I've kind of got a rapport going with one of the talk show hosts there, but I told him, I said, well, there's three things. Number one, if they're going to hit you where you live, you got to hit them where they live, which they're doing. They're going to these legislators' houses and demonstrating in front of their house.
Yep. Did you see the one big story? It was Hopper was his name. Turns out he doesn't even live in the district, and he lives with his 25-year-old mistress.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. That's
so right. That out of what you just said, that information came out of doing just what you said.
Right. Another group that I want to pull out of the woodwork, and I don't even know if it's legal, but I'll just say it, you know, whoever the hacktivists are from behind Anonymous, since you're, you know, now that you've already gotten all your stuff on Bank of America, why don't you go ahead and start digging on these boys and see what you can find out.
Yeah.
And thirdly, Rick, my friend, what is it about the union that they don't understand? You know, they think that they're just going to break the union like some piece of China. Have they never heard of the fact that we're all connected to international unions? They seem to forgot about Lech Walesa and the Gdansk shipyard. You know, the American unions were involved in that, too. So when you mess with one of us, you're messing with all of us. And if you think we're going to break, you got a sneak, boy, you got another thing coming.
Well, I mean, that's what they're planning on. They're planning on working people being, you know, as, you know, I think George Meany said it back in the late 60s. How am I going to get a guy to strike when he's making $10,000 a year, which back then was a lot of money? How are you going to get someone to, you know, to go walk across the picket line, walk on a picket line when he's doing all right? I'm saying that right now is that time where people are looking at their wallets going, we're kind of hungry. Maybe it's time we do start to stand together. Maybe a general strike would not be a bad idea.
Well, you know, it's a well-known song. Freedom's just another word, and I'm telling you, you think, you know, you may have something to lose right now, but it won't be very long. You won't have nothing to lose, and that's when we're going to get even more dangerous. And lastly, on the 9/11, my brother-in-law was a union iron worker down in Florida working at the Cape when all that went down. He got in his car. He drove to New York. He worked on that pile for 8 months, and when he left to go up there, besides the job he walked away from, he didn't know who was going to pay him or if he was even going to get paid when he got there.
Yep.
You know, and that's something that needs to be advertised. A lot of those union brothers, they went up there and they didn't have a clue. They weren't even thinking about getting paid. They just showed up. And you know what? That speaks volumes for who our people are versus the slime bags that sit in these offices and think they're going to pull this kind of crap.
And you look at what they've done. You look at what the people that we pulled out of the rubble, look what they're doing to us now.
Exactly. I appreciate it, Ricky. You have a good evening.
Thanks so much, Ike. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Richard Eskow, we're going to talk about the M&I bank situation. Again, ionmandi.com is our website. I on Mandy, it looks like. Take a look at that. We're right back after this.
So here I stand with a long line of cars, everyone yelling at me. When did I become a problem? How did this fault become all mine? The president says, I'm tightening the belt. The only one that's tightening is mine.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
On Wednesday, workers, their unions, and supporters of workers' rights will rally in Lansing, Michigan to protest attacks on worker rights. It's part of a national movement defending worker rights against the coordinated national attack on workers and unions. Michigan Republicans are pushing 40 anti-union, anti-worker bills through the legislature. The Michigan AFL-CIO is urging all workers, unions, and community supporters to turn out Wednesday to protest this attack in Lansing. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the mass workers' movement sparked in Wisconsin is an historic opportunity that must not be lost.
In your lifetime, have you ever seen this much solidarity? Have you ever seen this much excitement, this much activism? Let me say, as progressives, it's our job to transform the outrage and to make this moment a movement, to ensure that this corruption in the Midwest does not stand. And we have the immense responsibility to keep the fire lit, spark real change for America.
On April 6th, a federal court will hear a motion by National Football League players to order owners to lift the lockout of the players. Owners want to grab $1 billion more off the top of league revenue and force players to play more games. The AFL-CIO says it stands with the players, just as members of the Green Bay Packers stand with Wisconsin public workers in their fight over collective bargaining. Dennis Kucinich connects the anti-labor dots in the Midwestern states. Jesse Russell reports.
Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich was one of the speakers at what has become known as the largest rally in Wisconsin's history on Saturday. The congressman used the opportunity to connect the dots between the battles that are unfolding in Indiana, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Michigan.
In the past week, a bill has moved along that would strip the right of collective bargaining for Ohio's public workers, that would put them in harm's way should they decide to strike, because then replacement workers would come in and then would set the stage for privatization. And after all, isn't what this is all about?
Kucinich said the various pieces of legislation being proposed and passed in those states amount to a power grab by corporations who want to see the public sector privatized. He also referred to a portion of Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's budget repair bill that would sell off state power plants via a no-bid contract.
What they believe in is government of the corporations, by the corporations, for the corporations. That might work on Wall Street, but it's not going to work in Wisconsin. And it's not going to work in Ohio. And it's not going to work in Michigan.
This newscast made possible in part by the National Education Association and AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Last week we talked about this M&I Bank and the fact that you had workers in Wisconsin going, you know what? Your executives gave money to Scott Walker. You promoted this guy. We're taking our money out of your bank. And they took a boatload of money out, moved it into other institutions. And now you're seeing other areas around the country doing the same thing, and the right was losing their mind. These are union thugs. How dare they take their money out and do what we've been telling people to do for generations? How dare they? You figure it out, because I can't. But Richard Eskow has written an excellent piece on this entire thing. Wisconsin governor's allies ran a toxic bailout bank and got rich. Richard, welcome to the program.
Good to be here, Rick.
Tell the people exactly, you know, walk us through this step by step. From the beginning, how'd this start?
Well, I'll tell you, these guys didn't run themselves a very good bank. They wrote a lot of very bad, what they call toxic loans. So they had a lot of toxic assets on the books, meaning that they had a lot of loans, more than 5%, that weren't performing. People weren't paying back. It was a bad risk. They didn't have enough capital to manage all of that. They were in deep trouble. The taxpayer came in and bailed them out with about $1.5 billion, little more in money to keep them floating and to protect them, I would say, from the consequences of their own actions. And even though banks that get bailed out aren't supposed to be able to pay their executives big bonuses, now they're selling their bank to the Bank of Montreal, and these guys are going to get huge paydays, multi-million dollar paydays for running a bad bank.
Yeah, to cash in off the taxpayer. How much TARP money did they get?
It's a little more than $1.5 billion that they owe the American people.
Now, if the Bank of Montreal buys them, they're still obligated to pay that back?
Yeah, the reason why that's happening is, see, the regulators are worried about the TARP money that hasn't been paid back yet. And let's face it, these guys are shaky financially. So the talk is that the regulators probably kind of gone to the Bank of Montreal's head and said, you know, nice little business you got here. Now buy this bank and take this loan off our hands. So, and then the guys at M&I figured out this was a nice way to work around the bonus deal too, because they have something in their contracts that says if our bank gets sold, we get a nice cushy payday, like $18 million, maybe up to $27 million for the CEO, and then nice packages for the rest of the guys. So it all works out very nice and neat and tidy. Eventually, supposedly, they'll pay the taxpayer back after it gets sold. At least that's the plan, but there's no promise of that.
And what bothers me again, you know, the fact is, you know, these fat cats who caused this mess, we are somehow, they always figure out how to get into the taxpayer's pocket, don't they?
They do, and they always figure out how to get paid off too, and they figure out how to make it tricky to know what they're doing. You know, we've all been reporting about the money they've given Scott Walker, but you just take one guy, like I'm thinking of Kenneth Cry, I think his name is a senior vice president. If you go in through the campaign contribution records, you'll find Kenneth Cry and Ken Cry and Ken C. Cry and Melinda Cry and Melinda S. Cry. So, you know, it's kind of hard to tell how much the family's contributed. The only thing you can know for sure is that these guys are doing great and a lot of other people not so much.
So now some people found out and they've decided, you know what, we're not going to this bank. We're going to pull our money out. We're going to take it somewhere where people aren't going to hurt us.
Well, that's right. And there are a lot of places to go where you can do that. And by the way, you know, M&I has banks all over in a number of states, too, in Arizona, Minnesota, Missouri, Kansas, Nevada, Florida, Illinois. So, you know, if you're in an M&I bank or any other bank that's not treating you right, then you got a lot of alternatives. One of your alternatives is to go to the Move Your Money website and find a credit union or a community bank that isn't out to get you at the same time that they're out to get your money.
Right. What do you say to the, you know, because I've had a lot of conservatives say, you know, well, you know, this is thuggery. You know, you guys are doing what we've been doing. This idea that somehow by using your dollars and using your consumer consumer rights, if you will, somehow that's thuggery. Do you see that?
It's nuts. I mean, I thought these guys believed in the free market, which they do until the free market works against them. The free market says, I don't like the way you run your business. I go to another business. And I got news for M&I Bank. I don't like the way you run your business. So we've got the right to go wherever we want with our money. And I encourage people to do that. And the idea that it's thuggery is just, hey, you know how it is with a bully. You know, everybody looks like a bully to a bully.
Yeah.
So it's just doing the thing you ought to do with your money, which is investing it wisely and with businesses you want to support.
You know, what do you say to that? Because there have been some claims that, you know, the union just trying to put them out of business. I don't see that. If they're that poorly run that this amount of money is going to harm them, I guess they didn't have a very good business model to begin with.
Well, we know that already, that they didn't have a good business model except for themselves. But what we do know is, I have no idea what that sound is, by the way. But what we do know is that this is a wake-up call. It's a way to get their attention. It's a way to say to them, and every other bank in the country, if you do this kind of thing, if you work to undermine our rights, if you work to undermine the American middle class, you're going to pay a price, you're going to lose money. I would guess that every bank in the country is looking at this, and if there's a real serious penalty to be paid on the part of M&I Bank, it's going to be a wake-up call for all of them. So I would encourage people to really pull out of that bank.
Yeah, I'm with you. The article, Wisconsin Governor's Allies Ran a Toxic Bailout and Got Rich by Richard Eskow. We got a link over at therickssmithshow.com. You can click on it, take you there. It's an interesting read. You know, I've been saying this is the kind of stuff we've been needing to do for, well, for a generation now. Use our buying power, use our strength to help those who are our allies and punish those who want to punish us. And I think this is a great thing. I'd love to see more of it.
You bet. They're profiting off the American people, the American working people, the American middle class. And if they want to keep doing that, what better way to spend our money than to let them know that they're going to have to work with us and not against us?
Yeah, because the right figured this out years ago. Whenever an advertiser goes on Limbaugh's show or whenever an advertiser goes on those other ones, their ideologically bent folks patronize them. They sell. For some reason on our side, on the leftward side of things, that consumer part of our being doesn't equate into the same thing as it does on the right.
And you know what? They count on that. So that's why the equation has to change, and we've got to be the ones to change it. Because they assume that we'll keep on bailing them out with our tax dollars and keeping them solvent by doing business with them, and that there'll be no penalty to pay for it. And we have every right to say, no, we don't want to do business that way. And it's time we started.
Have you got an estimate of how much money's been moved so far? I've seen some pretty high estimates.
The last figure I heard was north of $200,000. That was a little over a day ago, before the weekend. I don't know what the latest count is. And then there's a researcher at one of the unions who says that the unions in total have about $1 billion in pension fund money sitting with the bank. So if they decide to step up and do – I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what he estimates, and it sounds right. So if they decide to step up, that could really be a wake-up call for these guys.
$1 billion in M&I.
In M&I specifically, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a major move and major pain for them.
Yeah, and I think there comes a time to do that. And, you know, M&I has said, well, you know, it wasn't us as a bank that helped Walker. It was these executives as individuals. And, you know, the answer is these executives are still running your bank. We don't have faith in them as bankers because they ran a toxic bank and had to be bailed out. They're not helping us. They're using the money you're giving them to work against us. Maybe you need a new set of executives over there.
Yeah, I agree. One of the things I've always said is that I've always thought labor should have started their own banks and they should have had their health care because they've got the mass buying power. Because, look, you've got 12 to you know, when you start talking about families, 12 to 25% of the population. That is a huge chunk of the population you could pull into creating banks and health insurance and all of the other things that we need that we hand out money to big corporations for.
Well, you know, the infrastructure is there. There's a skeleton already to build on with the credit unions and some of the other organizations that are out there that they've learned how to work with each other and to turn themselves into a kind of network so that you can share services and ATMs and all of that stuff. So I think there's a way to do that, and I think that's a terrific idea. I think that there's no reason. This is supposed to be the land of the free where if we want to do business in a certain way, we can get together and do it, and I don't see why not.
Yeah, but I got to tell you, I've really been enjoying listening to the right whine and complain and say, oh, they're a bunch of thugs for doing exactly what the right has been preaching for years.
Well, you know, it's interesting because they would probably call me a thug, too, for pointing out that these executives aren't good at their jobs and aren't helping the middle class. But, hey, you know what? We just saw these guys forced out that NPR because they had political opinions they didn't like. Well, that had nothing to do with customers and people and money and all of that. But the right wanted, and it turns out to be a frame-up, the white right was very happy to sort of frame these guys and set them up and get rid of them. But if you have a legitimate complaint about what people are doing at a bank where you put your money, and so you take your money elsewhere, they call you a thug. That just doesn't make any sense at all.
That's an excellent point. And I got to be honest, one I never thought of. I mean, you look at the fact that they are doing the exact same thing. And really, to be honest, they don't have a stake in that game whatsoever. It was just a political hit job.
Well, that's what they'll do. They'll single out people and go after them. And we're not doing that here. We're just saying, look, you know, if you want to, we're not saying to M&I Bank, you have to get rid of these guys. We're just saying we're gone.
We're taking our money and going somewhere else.
That's all. We didn't sting them. We didn't send in a video camera and pretend to. Well, yeah, we did, actually. The David Koch call, that was pretty good. But to Scott Walker. But we didn't sting these guys at the bank. And we're just saying we're taking our money elsewhere because we don't like the way you do business. And to me, that's the American way.
Absolutely. The website is moveyourmoneyproject.org. They'll even show you where there's a credit union or a bank nearby that would be a much better fit for you, probably. We'll put a link to that at thericksmithshow.com for you right there. Richard, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much, brother.
You bet. Good to talk to you, man.
Great article. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
For and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
No doubt you will be as pleased as I was to learn that the Securities and Exchange Commission is cracking down on those unconscionable pay packages that Wall Street elites keep grabbing. By a 3-2 vote, SEC Commissioner socked the money-grubbing bankers with a new say-on-pay rule. Rather than let top executives lavish money on themselves unchecked, the new rule lets shareholders of these financial giants vote on extravagant salaries, bonuses, and perks. That'll rein in the excess, right? Probably not. You see, the SEC has long been a gentle regulator, never wanting to hear a Wall Streeter say, ouch. Thus, the say-on-pay rule has no bite. Shareholders can indeed have their say, but it's a non-binding vote. Bank big shots can simply ignore it. Yet, even this velvet harness was too rough for the two soft-on-greed Republican commissioners, Kathleen Casey and Troy Paradis. Both voted no, with Casey explaining that the new rules are, quote, unduly restrictive and impose unnecessary burdens on bankers. Don't despair, though, for justice still might be served. The SEC has since approved another compensation crackdown, this time specifically targeting outrageous multimillion-dollar bonuses. For the first time, big banks will henceforth be compelled to restrain themselves. How? By filing detailed annual reports about the bonuses they pay. Ouch, that'll sting, won't it? Again, though, even this tiny inch was too harsh for the compassionate Republican members. Both sided with the poor bankers, weighing that requiring reports is a big government intrusion into the private sector, overreaching the SEC's authority. This is Jim Hightower saying, luckily, a group named Bankster USA is rallying grassroots support to curb banker greed. For real reform, contact BanksterUSA.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.com.
Radio of, for, and by, We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
One 888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Jesse Russell has an interesting piece. He talks about Wisconsin politicians trying to raise some money, but evidently in Wisconsin it's not going very well. So what did they do? What did the Republicans there do? They've moved to Washington D.C. where they can hold their little fundraiser for a grand a person. Yes, this March 16th, you too can go to the Wisconsin Republican Party's little shindig for a grand ahead. It is the fundraiser will be held at the headquarters of Babar Griffith and Rogers LLC. Babar, is that like Haley Babar? Yes, the Mississippi governor was one of the people who started this lobbying firm, according to the group's website. With BGR at your side, you have a powerhouse partner in global government, commerce, and media. BGR provides proven success in lobbying, crisis management, and media relations. And I would say Republicans in Wisconsin are in crisis mode, and they need somebody. So, you know, hey, maybe someone as well-connected as Haley Babar, maybe he can help them. But one of the big clients there has been this Milwaukee company, Jesse Russell points out, We Energies, which has spent more than $300,000 lobbying with Babar's company. We Executives also donated more than $10,000 to Walker's campaign. So, you know, nice little thing there. So if you're in town, if you're in D.C. on the 16th, the Republicans there in Wisconsin could really use your help because they're broke. Also, if you wanted to sponsor a table, you know, you want to sponsor $2,500 if you want to be a host, only $5,000. So that's almost a steal. Almost a steal. Anyway, going to Michigan. I mean, these attacks have been all across the country. Everywhere where you look, you're seeing budgets being slashed. Florida here, Arizona, Ohio, Wisconsin, all across the country, you've seen these so-called deficit reduction plans. Basically stealing from public employees, stealing from Kids for the Future, stealing from middle-class taxpayers like you and me, because understand, our property taxes are going to go through the roof next year. It is going to happen. Either that, or we're going to have a bunch of dumb kids. What I find funny, though, is the Republicans don't seem to have any problem cutting corporate taxes. In Michigan, this Rick Scott has proposed ending the state's earned income tax credit. He's proposed cutting the $600 per child tax credit. He's proposed reducing credits for seniors. Also, he wants to cut funding for school districts by about 8 to 10%. At the same time, the Michigan League for Human Services found that the state's business taxes would be reduced by nearly $2 billion. And that equates to about 86% of the tax base that comes from corporations. An 86% cut for corporations, you know, the people who put him into power, and the people who need services, that 86% or that $2 billion would have funded, I guess they're basically on their own. And I guess it's this whole mentality that the right seems to have ingrained in them, that give everything to corporations and they will bestow employment upon us. Yet no period in the history of our country has that ever worked. The only time that the economy has really boomed is when you have a large middle class that has disposable income. And that generally happens when you have pressure to push wages up, which means collective bargaining, which means people coming together saying, I'd like a little bit of what I'm creating. The right, on the other hand, all they keep whining about are minimum wage. And, oh, we got to pay that nasty minimum wage. I was over at the Red State blog, and I generally don't read Red State, but for some odd reason I felt the urge today. And I came across this piece on minimum wage, which is another one of those, when you talk to Republicans, when you talk to these ideological conservatives who seem to be, you know, they have their dime store economics, it seems to make an excellent argument. Let me read some of this to you. It says, in 2006, the last full year in which the U.S. federal minimum wage was a constant value throughout the whole year, approximately 6.6 million individuals in the U.S. earned the minimum wage of $7.25 an hour or less. For 2010, the first full year in which the U.S. federal minimum wage was a constant value throughout the year. Since 2006, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics estimates that there are just 4.3 million individuals earning the same equivalent, the minimum wage. He basically does some simple-minded math. That means that there are 2.2 million jobs lost in the economy since 2006, and this is what they write, that they were directly impacted by the series of minimum wage increases that were mandated by the federal government in 2007, 8, and 9. I'm looking at this and I'm going, really? That's your argument? There were 6 million jobs in 2006, 6.6. There are just about 4.4 today. So the only thing that in this guy's mind that changed was an increase in the minimum wage. So that those minimum wage jobs must have gone away solely because government had the audacity to raise the minimum wage. They write, so in percentage terms of the change of total of employment at the level of 2006 to 2010, jobs affected by the federal minimum wage hike of 2007, 2008, 2009 account for 41.2% of the total job reductions since 2006. Think about this for a second. What they're writing here, and this is masterful if you're talking to simpletons, because it completely takes out the 2008 collapse and all of the jobs, the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of jobs that were lost because of the economic policies of the ideological right. This idea of deregulations, of banks doing whatever it is they want to do, of Wall Street running the economy. It's beautiful. It's beautiful simpleton logic, saying that we had these jobs in 2006, they are now gone, so it must be the federal minimum wage. And they're actually making an argument for repealing part of the minimum wage. And I go back to what I said a minute ago. The only time an economy really turns around and you have expansion is when people have money in their pockets to consume. So if we take even the part of the minimum wage away, because we do know that there are very few people making minimum wage contributing to their 401k. There are very few minimum wage people putting money into a health savings account. There are very few people making minimum wage putting money into a college account. There are very few people making minimum wage investing in high risk stock funds or derivatives. These folks are buying food. They're existing. And the ideological right wants to take even that away under this idea that if we take the minimum wage away, we can create jobs. Just like the argument they made in South Korea, that it was those evil white union people who mandated a minimum wage so that poor black guy would be willing to make it work for a dollar an hour, couldn't get a job. Well, what kind of a job is a dollar an hour when the minimum wage should be five? What kind of society do you want unless that is what you want? I don't. Which is why we're seeing people across the state, up in the Poconos, standing up for their rights. Which is why when we come back, we're going to talk with Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. Which is why we're seeing people in the streets saying we demand a reasonable standard of living. We demand respect, dignity. We demand it. We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
SECU, we know holiday bills can really pile up and hit you with double-digit interest rates or fees that start to snowball. Next thing you know, you're buried in a mountain of debt.
dig out by using our 3.9 annual percentage rate Visa balance transfer. Good through December 31st, 2012. That's a really big deal. And you heard that right. Our really big deal, 3.9% APR, is good through December 31st, 2012. And we don't charge you a balance transfer fee. So if you used any other credit card to pay for your holiday purchases, move those high interest rate balances to your PSEC Visa. The sooner you get in on this really big deal, the more you'll save. Financing Life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pscc.com/life to get in on our really big deal Visa balance transfer. Don't wait. Start saving.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, I know tomorrow morning they're going to be fired up. Members of SEIU Healthcare Pennsylvania will be taking to the curb, striking against Pocono Medical Center. We're going to be up there to cover it tomorrow, bring you some feedback, some information from the picket line, find out what it's about. We've talked to the folks up there in the past. This is going to be a three-day event. Because you've got to raise awareness. Sometimes when you're in negotiations, you need something to maybe get a little shot in the arm to let the other side know that you're serious. Maybe this will help jumpstart some negotiations. I hope so. You look at all the things, all the labor strife going on right now, and at the end of the day, what you've got is you've got business owners and governors who they just don't want to sit down and negotiate. It seems to be against their nature. That's why we've got to stand together. I've got Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO on the line. Frank, thanks for taking time for me.
Good evening, Rick. How's things going down there in the war room?
So far, so good. We're slugging in here. Let's talk about a couple of things going on around the state, if you would.
Sure.
This Hoffman Industries, I understand, locked their employees out today.
Actually, last week they did, Rick, and, just as you were telling the viewers, it just seems like for some reason more and more employers are finding it not within their appetite to bargain with their employees. And it really is, it's sad. It's a sad state of affairs. I think a lot of this has certainly been brought on by the activities that we've all been witnessing for the last several weeks, certainly that you were at personally for several days. But, you know, more and more that we see it, we just have a failure to communicate in so many levels.
Yeah, you know, I look at this, and I guess you could look at it two ways. One, that employers feel emboldened by a downturned economy to steal from their employees, or two, employees have just had enough and they're standing up and fighting back.
Well, there's no question they are standing up and fighting back, and enough. And, you know, you had talked about the lockout, you know, that is occurring right now as we speak. And there are several lockouts, as a matter of fact. But workers are standing up for themselves. They are standing up for their livelihood, their professions, whether it's a football player or somebody that makes steel or that is a healthcare professional. You know, workers are out there. You know, you can only take so much and in an economy that we're living in right now. And, you know, especially when in so many of these cases, Rick, the employers are turning a handsome profit. And that's probably an understatement to say handsome profit, a tremendous profit. You know, take the NFL Players Association. You know, we're talking about $9 billion in annual revenue. And as you and I have talked before, this particular situation isn't just about the players themselves. Certainly, it is about the professionals, no question about that, but it's all the thousands and thousands of other jobs that are related to the football industry itself, you know, from hotels that certainly draw in handsome profits, and restaurants and bars, wine and spirit stores, those who serve us at the games, those who work as ushers at the games and at the restaurants, and certainly sell the memorabilia. And, you know, it's all interconnected. And when you have situations where employers want to take folks that have been working faithfully their entire life in a mill, for example, difficult conditions, that want them to basically, you know, take half of what they were making at one point. Imagine, I don't care what field you work in, if somebody came up to you tomorrow and said that all of a sudden, you know, it's not good enough, we're not going to take 10% or 20%, and maybe we'll take half of your earnings, and then maybe we'll ask you to throw in a massive copay on your insurance to boot. It just doesn't add up. It doesn't make sense, especially when profits are showing that they are making a great deal of money.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up because, you know, one of the arguments I've been making is that what we're seeing in Wisconsin, in places like Ohio and Indiana and, well, Idaho and Utah and all of these public sector workers who are coming out and saying, we want to defend our standard of living. We want to defend our middle class existence. And the people that you're seeing who may oppose that are people who have been used to this idea of at-will employment, this idea that the boss can take whatever he wants, whenever he wants, and that they're helpless against fighting back. And that's, to me, a very foreign concept. But some of the folks that I've talked to who are not in favor of public collective bargaining, that's their mentality, that, you know, the boss should have this at-will, you know, this at-will mentality, and, you know, I'm there at his pleasure.
I wish that all of your listeners would actually spend a little bit of time and read the at-will doctrine, because you don't have to go very far to understand what that's all about. It simply says that you are an employee at will. And what that means is, for any reason, and it spells it out, for no reason, that you can be terminated. Your employment can be terminated with a stroke of a pen. The boss doesn't like what you're wearing, doesn't like how you cut your hair, doesn't like anything about you. Without a union and a collective bargaining agreement in place, that you are at the mercy, certainly, of the boss being judge and jury over everything that happens to you at work, regardless if you've worked there for 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years. And this is what we've seen. Take a look at it, to the listeners. You know, take a look. It's easy to find. At will is a very serious subject.
And it is the law of Pennsylvania. Unless you're covered by a collective bargaining agreement, you are at the will of your employee, your employer. They can fire you for any reason. They can change your employment for any reason, as long as they don't violate federal labor law, which are some very few things like my racial, age, gender, those type of things.
And I've done a lot of organizing over my career, and more often than not, when workers come to organize, it really is rarely about the economics. It's about those working conditions that you often talk about. It's about having a seat at the table when discussing conditions at work and, you know, hopefully conditions into your retirement after you've dedicated entire lifetimes, in many cases, to an employer. But that's really what it comes down to. It comes down to workers just hoping to have a voice at the workplace. And so many times we know and we've seen that it's really the workers that are the experts on the jobs. They know their jobs better than anybody. They are really what makes it work. I listened to the commercial with Director Filmon just a few moments ago, and you know, there's a slogan that asks me, makes Pennsylvania work, and it absolutely does. And when you look around, you know, the union workers, those people on the jobs, they are making the workplaces what they are today. They are the most valuable natural resource that any employer can have, and I can't think of a better place than Pennsylvania that has such a wealth of this great commodity called, you know, workers that understand the strong work ethic and, you know, ask for really nothing more than just to have a little bit of a conversation and the conditions that affect them. And honestly, it comes down to how it affects the employer as well. We need the employer, and we need the employer to be profitable. And you know, that's what the relationship is was intended to be all about. That's what the relationship is that we strive for every single day.
Well, that's an interesting point you make, Frank, because the reality is, and I think it was Samuel Gompers who said, if a corporation doesn't run out of profit, it should be considered criminal.
Isn't that the truth?
And, you know, but here's the thing. Organized labor tends to get a bad name because you do demand decent wages, decent conditions. You demand part of what labor creates, and it's, you know, the message that's out there, the mean that's being pushed, is somehow by demanding a little bit more, a reasonable existence, that you put companies out of business. And I say that that's not even remotely close to the truth, but, you know, I'll let you expound upon that.
Why is it that the word contract scares so many people? Because in every walk of everyday life, we have contracts. We sign a contract when we buy a home. We sign a contract when we buy an automobile. There is not one CEO out there, and I would love them to call in this evening and say that they are working for their boss because they answer to shareholders, et cetera. No matter where you are at the top of the employment food chain, you have some type of an agreement. You have an employment agreement, a contract that states the conditions of your employment very, very clearly. So why is it that everyday average rank-and-file workers can't enjoy the same basic rights that so many others do, that so many would not dare to engage in or go and work at a place where you could not have that kind of guarantee or that have that contract? And our contracts, by comparison, are so incredibly small. And, you know, it probably to some of these CEOs and corporate fat cats, it's probably laughable, you know, is that all that they're asking for? My goodness, you know. I make that maybe what they make in a week, you know, I might make in 1 hour.
Yep.
You know, imagine that. And the disparity has grown so huge that I don't know how we catch up. I don't know how we kind of like close that gap, because that's really where so much of the problems are. And then when these folks either leave on their own or asked to leave, nobody, even when they're asked to leave, and I put that in parentheses, walks away with nothing. You know, I mean, they walk away with very nice golden parachutes and benefits that you and I could never dream of.
Whenever I talk about that, I always think of Robert Nardelli, the current CEO of Chrysler. When Robert Nardelli was CEO of Home Depot, Home Depot stock plummeted. The board fired him, and on the way out the door, they said, "Oh, by the way, here's your $210 million check."
Well, I don't know of any of our members that are seeing a $200,000 check if they are asked abruptly to leave. I'm just not sure that it's out there. But your point is very well taken. And it's not unique either, Rick, is it? It is out there. It's all throughout corporate America. And, you know, this is March. They say it's March Madness, and there's a lot of madness going on, I could tell you, in Pennsylvania.
Will you be up in the Poconos tomorrow at Pocono Medical Center? Because we're taking our bus up there. We're gonna talk to the folks up there and cover the event, because I think it's important to stand with the people who are on the picket line.
It's incredibly important. And tomorrow, important at business as well, President Bloomingdale and myself, and certainly the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO and its 800,000 members, are in total support of what those caregivers are doing up there at the Poconos. However, tomorrow also happens to be a special election, the only election that I'm aware of in the entire country tomorrow, Tuesday, March the 15th, and that is in Senate District 11. That is the Berks County area.
Right.
And we're going to be doing an election in which we have endorsed and are wholeheartedly supporting Judy Schwenk and her bid to become the next senator. Judy was a former county commissioner out there. We think that she is the right candidate at the right time to fill that slot. And the message to all of your listeners, please, it's absolutely an election day. It is the only thing that you'll find on the ballot. It's going to be a decent day weather-wise. If I had my crystal ball, I'd be able to say that. But I do believe it's going to be a decent day. There's no excuses not to get out there. This is a very, very important race, and it's an important seat that we need to make sure that we are able to hold. This is the seat that became vacant, as you know, due to the unexpected death of Senator O'Fake.
Right.
And so tomorrow is election day in District 11, and that's where we will find ourselves, you know, hoping that we bring home a victory.
Well, I mean, to me, what I said about this last week is the reality is this election could be that referendum on the budget talk that the governor had the other day. Do you and the opponent, I think his Medaglia, I believe his name is, said, you know, I support the governor's budget wholeheartedly. I welcome it. I applaud it. And I think everybody else does, too. I think the people of that district ought to send the governor a message and say, you know, cutting $1 billion from education, not supporting that. Raising my property, forcing my property taxes to go up, not thrilled with that. That would be my take on it.
And you're absolutely right, which is why it is just so important that we get folks to turn out for tomorrow's election, because it absolutely will become a referendum, and it is probably the last bulkhead, so to speak, that can prevent some of these drastic cuts. And you're exactly right. Her opponent has remarked that it would be just another rubber stamp. He would absolutely be a rubber stamp for the kinds of cuts that we're seeing. And he specifically cited the education cuts, which are deep. They are enormous. They are hurtful. And I think that there's alternatives out there that we don't have to see the likes of the cuts that we're talking about. My goodness, we're talking about education. And, you know, there's not a lot of places that I'm aware of that invest more in our criminal system than we do in our education system. And, you know, if you're looking for that kind of a candidate, you're looking for that kind of government, then, you know, maybe that's the person for you. I don't think that the folks in Pennsylvania, certainly not in that Senate district, have the appetite or the patience for more of the same. And, you know, it's been a dirty campaign. Certainly not on Ms. Schwenk's side, but, you know, when candidates don't talk about themselves, it tells me they have nothing to say. And if they choose to just talk about their opponent in such negative ways, they absolutely have nothing to say. So you know, folks should really take a look, you know, whether it's in Senate District 11 or throughout. I think that we learned a valuable, valuable lesson from Wisconsin, how quickly things can be taken away from us with a simple stroke of the pen. No debate. It puts you in mind that maybe we were all at-will employees. You know, it's just incredible, isn't it? That someone could come in and would actually have the ideology and believes that this is the way to govern. I'm not sure where these folks are coming from, and certainly not sure where they belong. But it's just not the America that I know, and certainly not the America I think that our listeners know.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I got a good place for him, but this is terrestrial. This is terrestrial radio. Frank Snyder, Pennsylvania AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer, I appreciate your time.
Rick, it's always a pleasure. Keep up the great work and keep on talking about the union out there.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Covering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have a box for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call them at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters? Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes, the poor get paid too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again. Because God is a Republican.
Yes, he is. He's a Republican, all right. Believes in free markets. Believes in corporations being able to sell for the highest price that they can get. Yes. Yes, Jesus would have been a used car salesman. Well, if you listen to what our friends on the right say, Jesus was a diehard capitalist. And if you believe what our friends on the extreme right, the family values people, they wouldn't have a problem with what the AP reported today, saying the price of preventing preterm labor is about to go through the roof. They write a drug for the high-risk pregnant women. Now remember, our friends on the right, they love pregnant women. They're a very pro-birth kind of folk. Now a drug for these women who are pregnant and may have some high risk, cost about 10 to 20 bucks per injection. That is until next week, when that price will shoot up to $1,500 per dose. Which means that, you know, the total cost during a pregnancy could be as much as $30,000. So, you know, I look at that and I go, I question, you know, the pro-birth people. If a low-income mother needs this, are they willing to raise the taxes to cover this? And the question I guess most people have is, you know, why has it gone up? Why so much? Why has it gone from 10 or 20 bucks a shot up to 1,500? They write that's because the drug, a form of progesterone, given as a weekly shot, has been made cheaply for years, mixed in special pharmacies that custom compound treatments are put together, and they're not federally approved. So KV Pharmaceuticals, a company in St. Louis, they went to the federal government, said, you know what? We'd like to get approval. We want the FDA approval, so give it to us, and we'll sell the drug exclusively. They got that approval, so now they make this drug called Makena, and they are the sole person that can sell this. The March of Dimes and many obstetricians, they were all in favor of it, because you know what? If you got a company who's going to make it, it's going to be a better quality, it'll be more consistent, it might even be easier to get. So, you know, this is a good, they're looking at it, this is a good thing. Not one of them expected the price to shoot through the roof like it did, though. Dr. Roger Snow, Deputy Medical Director for Massachusetts Medicaid Program, said that's a huge increase for something that can't be costing them much to make. For crying out loud, this is about making money. Dr. Arnold Cohen, an obstetrician at Albert Einstein Medical Center there in Philadelphia, said, I've never seen anything as outrageous as this. Joanne Armstrong, head of women's health for Aetna, an insurance company, said, I'm breathless. So you've got a doctor for an insurance company who is actually breathless at the scope of thievery from a pharmaceutical company. I mean, you know, I guess there really is no honor among thieves, is there? Now, here's the problem I have. And a lot of the doctors in this article are saying, look, it's gonna skyrocket the cost of people getting these drugs, which could down the road mean that low-income people aren't going to be able to get it. The government's not going to have the money to pay for it. There aren't going to be programs available. Because after all, thanks to George W. Bush, we cannot negotiate for drug prices. Got to pay full price. So if KV Pharmaceuticals says the only way you're getting that $10 shot is to pay $1,500, guess what you're paying? You're paying $1,500. So now, if it doesn't get down to the folks at the bottom, the folks who are uninsured, the folks who are on Medicaid and the state's not going to cover it, what's this going to mean? Could mean more premature births. Could mean more physical disabilities. Could mean more mental disabilities. Now, you stop and think of how much does it cost to take care of a preemie child when they're born. They're saying in the first year alone, somewhere around $51,000. So my question is, do you then get into one of these weird kind of cost analysis where saying, well, if 50% of them come out preemie, you know, maybe we'll save some money by doing it that way. I mean, stop and think about that for a second. It is. It's all about profit, man. It's just, it's mind-blowing. And yet, I don't think you're going to find a Republican who's going to come out against this because it's the free market. And the free market has dictated that a mother who's going to have preterm labor is maybe willing to pay it. You got to love the family value stuff, don't you? I know I do. I'm fascinated by the family values. Republicans in the Senate on Monday threatened to delay votes on all trade nominees. Evidently, there's going to be a spot vacant in the Commerce Secretary's position. Republicans are saying, you know what? We're not going to fill any of your nominations, none of them, until you send us Colombia, Panama, and South Korea so Congress can vote on it. Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, told reporters that, quote, get all three of them up here, and you won't have any trouble confirming people. The same threat was conveyed in a letter to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, signed by 44 of the 47 Republicans. again, you know, they love this kind of no. We're going to twist arms. We're going to do what we have to do to stick you in the back. And again, you look at these trade agreements with Colombia and Panama and the one with South Korea, bad, bad stuff. We're going to take a break right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. On Wednesday, workers, their unions, and supporters of workers' rights will rally in Lansing, Michigan to protest attacks on worker rights. It's part of a national movement defending worker rights against the coordinated national attack on workers and unions. Michigan Republicans are pushing 40 anti-union, anti-worker bills through the legislature. The Michigan AFL-CIO is urging all workers, unions, and community supporters to turn out Wednesday to protest this attack in Lansing. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the mass workers' movement sparked in Wisconsin is an historic opportunity that must not be lost.
In your lifetime, have you ever seen this much solidarity? Have you ever seen this much excitement, this much activism? Let me say, as progressives, it's our job to transform the outrage and to make this moment a movement, to ensure that this corruption in the Midwest does not stand. And we have the immense responsibility to keep the fire lit, spark real change for America.
On April 6th, the federal court will hear a motion by National Football League players to order owners to lift the lockout of the players. Owners want to grab $1 billion more off the top of league revenue and force players to play more games. The AFL-CIO says it stands with the players, just as members of the Green Bay Packers stand with Wisconsin public workers in their fight over collective bargaining. Dennis Kucinich connects the anti-labor dots in the Midwestern states. Jesse Russell reports.
Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich was one of the speakers at what has become known as the largest rally in Wisconsin's history on Saturday. The congressman used the opportunity to connect the dots between the battles that are unfolding in Indiana, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Michigan.
In the past week, a bill has moved along that would strip the right of collective bargaining for Ohio's public workers, that would put them in harm's way should they decide to strike, because then replacement workers would come in and then would set the stage for privatization. And after all, isn't what this is all about?
Kucinich said the various pieces of legislation being proposed and passed in those states amount to a power grab by corporations who want to see the public sector privatized. He also referred to a portion of Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's budget repair bill that would sell off state power plants via a no-bid contract.
What they believe in is government of the corporations, by the corporations, for the corporations. That might work on Wall Street, but it's not going to work in Wisconsin. And it's not going to work in Ohio. And it's not going to work in Michigan.
This newscast made possible in part by the National Education Association and AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're a proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
I don't know. You know, the mainstream media in this area didn't cover it at all. But last Saturday, Tractorcade. I wish I was there. The Saturday that we were there, there were, I'd say somewhere near 100,000 people. I'm told the estimates are much higher than that this past Saturday, where you had all these farmers come to town and say, look, the governor's killing us too. I think this governor's, he's doing working people such a favor by drawing constituents together that have never really been eye to eye, that are drawing groups together that have had fences between them. I think Walker's tearing them down. Amazing stuff. And one of the people who was there, Scott Schultz, He is the executive director of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. He was raised on a dairy farm there in Clark County, Wisconsin, and continues to this day. Scott, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, tell me about Tractorcade. Tell me about Saturday. I wish I were there.
Oh, it was flat out emotional, an emotional experience for me. I've done a lot of different things in my life and experienced a lot of things, but getting on that tractor and seeing America, so to speak, pull together, and that was the theme, actually, was incredible. You know, there's been a lot of talk in the debate in Wisconsin here about folks pulling strings from the outside and directing things from the outside. But this truly was a grassroots effort. Farmers calling my organization and saying, we want to do this. And, you know, there were even accusations and debates. Well, these aren't real farmers or anything like that. They don't look like real farmers. Well, heck, I don't know that people know what a real farmer is supposed to look like, apparently, because
these were
real farmers.
Yeah, they went down to the local the tractor rental shop, and they got off the airplane and rented a tractor instead of a car. Yeah, that's what they did.
Absolutely. Yeah, and, you know, there's so much in common that when you find the common ground with the labor movement in general, starting especially in the 30s, Wisconsin Farmers Union was founded in 1930 to set up the state's much of what's become the state's cooperative system. And people ask us right away, you know, what is the link between farmers and organized labor and collective bargaining? They said, well, if you have ever sold any of your animals or your milk, as it is in Wisconsin, so much, you've sold that through a cooperative, you've been part of collective bargaining. That's what co-ops are all about.
Yeah, but I've got some friends who call what you say are co-ops, that's socialism.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess so. But I guess if that's socialism, you know, that's the way it is. Because the cooperative movement really is a huge among farmers across the country,
yep.
And that's what we are. And you know, further beyond even the collective bargaining issue, I personally felt from day one with the budget repair bill that Governor Walker has presented that it's much more than that. The other shoe was soon to fall, and the other shoe fell hard in his proposal in our biennial budget. It fell hard on rural Wisconsin. A person who's in another room in my house right now was sitting talking with me just a minute ago at a small school district in Athens, Wisconsin. 14 out of 44 teachers in that small school district, because of the collective bargaining issue, have been given pink slips. 14 out of 44 teachers in that small school.
Wow.
That small school is the heart of that community. It's by far the largest employer in that community, and it's going to cause that community's downtown to cease. They might be without public education in a lot of rural communities as the result of what the governor's proposals are doing.
You know, when we were there and we spent a week in Madison, and I liken it to a religious experience where really it rejuvenated my hope and my faith in humanity. I mean, to see that many people coming together and a lot of it wasn't even their own self-interest. It was for the betterment of a community, like you're talking about. That town is not going to have a school. They're not going to be educate kids. The other part of it, the badger care that I understand a lot of farmers benefited from. I was talking to union guys, and this is amazing to me. A union guy who's got probably the best health care you can get saying, I'm worried about the farmer, because he gets this program, and Walker wants to steal that from him. That kind of grabbed me.
More than 11,000 people on Wisconsin family farms are part of Use Badger Care.
That's a pretty substantial number.
That's an incredible number. And the reason they're using Badger Care is twofold, and that starts with the farmers aren't making, dairy farmers especially, you know that in Pennsylvania, I'm sure, yeah. are not profitable. And so they have very low incomes, and they cannot afford any health insurance. This is their last resort, and that's it's just sad that this could well be going away. And you know, you mentioned a religious experience. That's kind of an interesting thing that you mentioned that, because the governor was speaking with an agriculture group, a different agriculture group in Wisconsin just the other day, and the person who was there, I didn't hear it firsthand, but a person who told me secondhand said the story was told about how the governor walked out of his house one day and was thinking about what's going on in Wisconsin. And he looked up, it was a cloudy day, and all of a sudden the clouds opened and the sun shone down on him. And he said that apparently was the message that said he is doing the right thing, and that he actually told that agriculture group, "You are my chorus," to go out and pass this along. And, you know, the strange thing is, with more than 100,000 people, some estimated upwards of 200,000 on Capitol Square in Madison on Saturday, that it just happened to be a cloudy day. And you know what? The doggone sun, all of a sudden, the clouds opened up and the sun shone down on us. So, you know, I'm not a terribly religious guy, but the last I knew from any kind of religious studies about Christianity, that Jesus and God pick sides. So, you know, it's a religious experience for all of us, and it was as close to being a religious experience with our tractorcade and that rally in Madison the other day.
So let me ask you, going forward from here, because, you know, I when we left, my fear was that somehow the people would lose the steam as the governor cracks down and throws people out and locks down the Capitol building as he has done, that eventually people would kind of fall out by the wayside. It looks like it's getting stronger, and it looks like the momentum moving forward is stronger, even though that, you know, the collective bargaining thing has gone the wrong way right now. Are you seeing a resurgence? Are you seeing people more energized now than they were before?
You know, I have to tell you, I'm a U.S. Marine Corps veteran. And back in the day, I went through Marine Corps boot camp, they used pugil stick fighting to simulate hand-to-hand combat with rifles. And if you were weak or timid and you folded up, the drill instructors, much to those people's dismay, sent two or three other recruits with their pugil sticks after you, and they kept pounding on you and pounding on you, and the result would be almost to a man, a timid person would get teed off enough that they finally would jump up and all of a sudden start wailing back with their pugil sticks. And it turned the tide on many a person. And right now I see the governor as
part of the gang.
You know, he didn't see. Yeah, he's one of the group of people beating on the weaker person. And that weaker person is starting to kick back now. And, you know, another analogy, I thought about it with, we had former Texas Ag Commissioner and columnist Jim Hightower speaking at our rally on Saturday. And I looked down and, you know, if you've seen Jim Hightower around, he generally has a nice pair of cowboy boots on with pointy toes. And I thought, you know, Governor Walker just has up and kicked a sleeping dog with pointy-toed cowboy boots.
Yep.
With his pointy-toed cowboy boots. And that big, ugly mutt of a sleeping dog. You know, we look back at how much has the AFL-CIO been in the news in the past 10 years? You know, the entire labor movement, it was quieted. And, I've known many teachers who were, they were part of a teacher's union, and yeah, they negotiate our protection, and that the protection is the biggest thing that the teachers are going to lose out of this, by the way. But they protect, they negotiate our protection and some wages and benefits and wage packages and benefit packages. And they could take it or leave it. But so many of those people now feel themselves being hit with that pugil stick and being kicked with that pointed toe cowboy boot. And they're rising up. And they're rising up from the roots of this country, from the soil of this country, in middle America, with the farmers coming right up and saying, this has got to stop.
Yeah, it's not just Wisconsin. It's all over the country, I think. I think you've accurately portrayed that. It's an excellent analogy. If you want to help out the Wisconsin Farmers Union, they could use your help fighting back, taking donations. Just go to thericksmithshow.com and click on Scott Schultz's name. It'll take you to a page where you can make a donation, or you can go to wisconsinfarmersunion.com. This is some good video there of the event. And again, I wish I were there. This would have just been like coming home.
I invite everybody, please go and watch. There are links on it, or links to it on our site, or to go to Wisconsin Eye. It's a website, and see some of the heartfelt speeches. Tony Schultz, not related, but a farmer, gave one of the most moving and impassioned speeches I have ever seen anyone give. And it's straight from the heart, and again, straight from the soil. No strings pulled from outside sources.
WisconsinFarmersUnion.com, that's where you'll find that stuff. Scott, I appreciate your time. Thank you for the information, and thank you for the story.
Great. Thank you so much, and let's keep up the fight.
All righty. Keep that up. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
One place I'll be working. As long as my two hands are fit to use, I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
No doubt you will be as pleased as I was to learn that the Securities and Exchange Commission is cracking down on those unconscionable pay packages that Wall Street elites keep grabbing. By a 3-2 vote, SEC Commissioner socked the money-grubbing bankers with a new say-on-pay rule. Rather than let top executives lavish money on themselves unchecked, the new rule lets shareholders of these financial giants vote on extravagant salaries, bonuses, and perks. That'll rein in the excess, right? Probably not. You see, the SEC has long been a gentle regulator, never wanting to hear a Wall Streeter say, ouch. Thus, the say-on-pay rule has no bite. Shareholders can indeed have their say, but it's a non-binding vote. Bank big shots can simply ignore it. Yet, even this velvet harness was rough for the two soft-on-greed Republican commissioners, Kathleen Casey and Troy Paradis. Both voted no, with Casey explaining that the new rules are, quote, unduly restrictive and impose unnecessary burdens on bankers. Don't despair, though, for justice still might be served. The SEC has since approved another compensation crackdown, this time specifically targeting outrageous multimillion-dollar bonuses. For the first time, big banks will henceforth be compelled to restrain themselves. How? By filing detailed annual reports about the bonuses they pay. Ouch, that'll sting, won't it? Again, though, even this tiny pinch was too harsh for the compassionate Republican members. Both sided with the poor bankers, wailing that requiring reports is a big government intrusion into the private sector, overreaching the SEC's authority. This is Jim Hightower saying, luckily, a group named Bankster USA is rallying grassroots support to curb banker greed. For real reform, contact banksterusa.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.com.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Speaking of going down in a ring of fire, evidently Charlie Sheen is doing a one-man show. His show's in Detroit and Chicago next month. Sold out in just 18 minutes. That, I guess, is a record for Ticketmaster. The show known as Charlie Sheen Live, My Violent Torpedo of Truth, Defeat is Not an Option Tour. Again, sold out in 18 minutes. A dollar for every ticket will be given to the folks at Red Cross to help the earthquake victims in Japan. Ticket prices only up to $70. So if you want to see Insanity live in person, well, maybe he'll come to a town near us. What a kook. Let's go to the phone lines. We've got Mike on line one. How are we doing tonight, Mike?
Well, I've been a little busy this weekend, Rick.
Yeah, I can imagine. Tell me what's going on with the plants over in Japan.
Well, it isn't good. You notice that they've talked about the hydrogen explosions, one and two, and the one today.
Right.
Have you ever wondered where that hydrogen came from? I mean, it's not like they have a blimp filling station there anywhere.
Actually, no. Explain it to me.
Well, it's called a metal water reaction. The cladding around the fuel pellets in the reactor is made out of zirconium. What happens is that when the temperature of the core reaches about 2,000 degrees, recognize that a normal operating core is only between 500 and 600 degrees. When it gets up to about 2,000 degrees in that neighborhood, that zirconium reacts with water and releases lots of hydrogen, but also it's a violent exothermic reaction. It puts out a lot of extra heat that has to be dissipated. So if you see hydrogen explosion, that means your core is already severely damaged.
So let me ask you this, because I was listening to Hannity and a couple of these other right-wing shows who basically are saying that hasn't happened, that, you know, there are all these safeguards in place, that everything's fine, you know, the Japanese took all these precautions, everything's going to be wonderful, and that everything that we're hearing in the media is just a bunch of liberal extremists who want to deny the country of nuclear power.
I can assure you they are wrong. If you looked at the detonation today, if you look closely in the cloud that goes up, you can see what look like large curved parts. I believe that to be the dry well cover, which is the container around the reactor vessel itself. So, as I said, when you start generating large amounts of hydrogen, it already indicates that you have severe core damage, that your clad is failing. And the only thing that can happen at this point is if they are unable to get enough water in to cool that core mass, then that mass will start to really heat and it will coalesce into a molten mass and we'll have a full-fledged meltdown.
And what does that look like? Or don't we know?
Well, we've never seen one that went to the point where we actually liquefy ceramic pellet. TMI didn't do that. It rubblized the core, and they got water through it. One of the problems is that once you go past a certain point and your core starts to slump, you start creating a non-coolable geometry. Remember, a reactor core is designed with many, many, many flow channels to allow cooling water to flow around the fuel element. If you start collapsing the core so those flow channels aren't there anymore, you have a mass that becomes harder and harder to cool.
So,
in the case of Unit 2, we may be getting there.
So you could have two or more of these doing what you're describing all at the same time.
Could happen.
So explain to me, again, because I'm trying to put this into what type of catastrophe we're talking about. how large of a scale? How are we talking permanent? Are we talking thousands of years down the line? What kind of negative effects are we talking about?
Well, it really depends on several things and what happens. It could be everything from where the mass will disperse and cool to where the mass will result in a violent steam explosion and eject large amounts of core material out of the vessel. And it's difficult to predict exactly what will happen when. But it is a very serious, serious event. I saw in the media they have some imaginary scale that compares this with PMI, and they say PMI was worse. It is not. PMI was no matter anywhere near as bad as this.
Yeah, I was listening to the one talker, and that's what he was saying. Oh, TMI was much worse.
Yeah.
And you go, really?
Really?
I don't remember a major earthquake, you know, causing that kind of damage. I mean, because, you know, after all, there is the other part of this then. You know, because for those, and maybe there are some on the fringe who are going to use this as a way to be anti-nuclear power. This was a major catastrophe, a major earthquake that I don't know that you could have really planned for.
Well, here's what's interesting, Rick. The plants survived the earthquake fine. The plants have accelerometers that measure earthquakes and automatically shut the plant down. None of these reactors are running. All of them have their control rods inserted, and the nuclear chain reaction has been shut down. What happened next was, because the earthquake damaged the grid and they lost electric power to the plant, the diesel generators started up and ran normally and were providing emergency power. Then the tsunami rolled in and flooded those diesel generators and destroyed them. And then that left the plant with only battery power for the next 8 to 12 hours. After that, they have no power to run any of the cooling pumps. So the earthquake didn't do this. It took two events, earthquake and tsunami, to get us here.
So let me ask about the plants that we have here in this country. Is there any possibility of something like that happening here?
Well, first you would all look at coastal plants. Obviously, if you're not within a reasonable distance of the coast, that's not likely to happen. We have some reactors that are coastal plants. Some in Florida, some in California, and kind of one in New Jersey, but not really, and it's being shut down anyway. But could it happen? Well, how big is tsunami? You know, it depends on the initiating event. There are projections of tsunamis as high as 100 feet that could hit in places and could run miles in them. But it's impossible to design any technology for those kind of things. It's like trying to design any technology that will survive a major asteroid impact. So, in that sense, well, probably not. All of the plants in the United States are designed to have a design basis earthquake where the objective is the plant will be shut down and can be cooled and protected. In this case, though, the combination of the earthquake and the tsunami that flooded those diesel generators really changed the character of the event.
So in the coming days, what should we be looking for? You know, if things are going to turn south, what kind of, because I've got about a minute and a half left, what kind of things should we be looking for?
If you have an explosion, one or more of those plants, and that explosion is dramatically larger than what we've seen so far, that's probably an indication of a major steam explosion. If you remember in the case of Chernobyl, that plant was different. It went to extreme power, or jumped from 20% power to 1,000% power in an instant, and caused a massive steam explosion that destroyed the plant, and that plant did not have a containment structure. So what would we be looking for would be something on less than, but on the order of that, a major steam explosion, which would indicate a coalesced mass that gets water below it. Highly unlikely that that will occur, but not impossible.
Well, I hope you'll keep calling and keeping us abreast of what's going on. It's great to have a resource like you, Mike, and I appreciate it.
All right, sir. We'll talk to you later.
All right. We're going to take a break right back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. You know, internationally, it's been a rough day, but if you listen to our friends on the right, even they would say that the liberals wanted this thing to happen in Japan so they could shut down the U.S. by stopping us building any new nuke plants. Interesting take, but not anything near reality. But again, did you really think they'd have a grasp on reality? Anyway, let's find out what's going on around the world. I've got Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
What's going on today?
A great deal is going on, as a matter of fact. In Japan, the crisis, of course, is escalating. The death toll almost certainly higher than any of the estimates that we are getting. And also the nuclear crisis escalating, with experts concerned by the repeated exposure of fuel rods. At the White House press briefing today that I attended, Press Secretary Jay Carney was joined by the chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, who said that he believes the power plants in the U.S. operate safely and securely, and he said that many times. When he was asked a direct question about whether they could withstand an earthquake of this magnitude that we just saw in Japan, he didn't answer the question, but he did repeat that power plants in the U.S. operate safely and securely and talked about how strong they were. He was also joined by a Deputy Secretary of Energy, and he said at the White House briefing that nuclear energy will continue to be part of the Obama administration's energy policy.
Well, if you'd listen to the people on the right today, boy, this was the end of it. Liberals had wrapped it up. This is the game over.
Apparently not.
That tells you how out of touch and out of reality they actually are. Because I listened to Hannity on the way in here today, and he was just going nuts about how the liberals they want to take nuclear off the table.
Really?
Yeah, it was just nuts. They're using it at every turn to turn people away, and it was everything I've seen today from the mainstream media has been exactly what you said. They've got a crisis, they're working on it. Go forward.
That was exactly what the Deputy Secretary of Energy said about the Obama administration's policy. Now, whether there are some in Congress who may be viewing things differently, that's a completely different thing.
Right. Yeah, I, you know, my position on nuclear power hasn't changed any. It still takes too much water, in my opinion. But that's another argument. What else is going on?
Well, the whole question of the government shutdown. There is a continuing resolution that is to be voted on in the House tomorrow, and it was supposed to sail through, really. The idea was that it would fund the government until April the 8th, which is 3 weeks, and there would be $2 billion of cuts a week, which is not really acceptable to Democrats, but they were going to go along with it. And then along comes Representative Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio, who's head of the Republican Study Committee, which is a powerful conservative Republican group in the House that has, well over 150 members, who says that he's going to vote against it, putting pressure on other conservative members to vote against. And I think quite a number are going to vote against. Also, Senator Marco Rubio in the Senate is opposing it, may vote against, don't know if he definitely will. But it's turning into quite a big thing, and it's looking like now quite a number of Republicans in the House are going to vote this thing. Now, whether it's actually going to develop into a real problem for the Republican leadership or not at this point, that's not clear. They would have to have a full-scale revolt, really, of pretty much the entire Republican caucus. But with the Republican Study Committee, that could be between half and two-thirds of the Republicans.
Yeah, you know, you look at this, and the reality is I think the Tea Party is going to sink that ship.
Well, I mean, that could happen. I don't know if it's going to get to that point yet. Democratic Chuck Schumer, a senator from New York, said today that Speaker Boehner needs to dump the Tea Party and make a deal with moderate Republicans and Democrats if he wants to see things move along. Now, he partly said that because he thinks it, because he partly said it to needle the Republicans.
Sure. And then my response to that would be, are there really any moderate Republicans left?
Well, I mean, that is a question that some people are asking. Or if there are any moderate Republicans, do they have any power? It was interesting to notice that Senators Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins last week did vote with the rest of the Republicans in the Senate for the Republican budget-cutting bill, which cut $60-odd billion, and that included cutting all the funding of Planned Parenthood, all the federal funding of Planned Parenthood. Now, everybody knew they didn't mean that, because support funding for Planned Parenthood,
right,
but they went along with their caucus.
Amazing. Amazing stuff. What else is going on?
Well, a couple of interesting things overseas. In Bahrain, which isn't being talked about that much and probably should be, things are pretty messy. There have been some really quite violent protests, mostly by the Shiites. Bahrain, as you know, is ruled by a Sunni royal family, and the poorer people in Bahrain are Shiite, and they're the ones who are protesting. And now troops have entered the country, foreign troops from Saudi Arabia, about 1,000 of them, under the banner of the Gulf Cooperation Council, the White House saying that people should be treated with respect. But when asked a direct question, Jay Carney did not say that the Saudi troops should leave. So this is a very interesting development. It's very unusual for foreign troops to go into another country like this.
Yeah, I mean, this could get really ugly really quick.
Yeah, it really could. It really could. In Libya, meantime, Gaddafi has been making a number of gains against the rebels. The rebels really did seem to be in retreat, and things were looking quite bad for them. However, they have started to regain some territory that they had lost. So things are starting to turn about a little bit. This is very complicated desert warfare. You take some territory, but then you have to hang on to it. It's very difficult to hang on to it. But even if Gaddafi does manage to take some more territory, ultimately he comes up against Benghazi, which is a city of 1 million people, all of whom can't stand Gaddafi. And that's going to be very tricky.
Yeah, I read something earlier that Gaddafi said he would grant amnesty to anyone who surrenders.
That is what he's saying he will do, that he will grant amnesty. Now, whether that is true or not, what he has also said is we will bury this strife along with the planners and perpetrators. So that's your alternative.
Yeah, I was saying, you know, he would give them amnesty right before he had them shot in the head.
that's the worry, I think, of a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, this is an absolute mess. I had a conversation earlier with a friend who was saying that what we're seeing in the Middle East is a direct result of the wonderful policies of George W. Bush, and he was quite happy that we were seeing all of these people fighting for democracy because of George.
Yeah, well.
Tells you how twisted some of my friends are. What else we got going on in Washington?
The final thing I would just mention briefly is this whole issue of net neutrality, which is very important to a lot of people. It's actually important to anybody who goes online, but it's not being talked about very much. Senator Al Franken, Democrat of Minnesota, is going to introduce a bill that would make net neutrality violations a crime. Now, according to experts and congressional Democrats, the Justice Department can't take enforcement action against cable and phone companies who block websites. Basically, they can't do it. And he's not the only one who wants to do something about it. House Judiciary Intellectual Property Subcommittee Chair Bob Goodlatte, Republican of Virginia, is saying he may also introduce a bill to amend antitrust laws to address net neutrality, because that's the kind of law we're talking about. We're talking about antitrust.
Yeah, I mean, Comcast is going to be one of the biggest providers of Internet in the country. And if what you're saying is true, that you cannot enforce the rules against them because they are a cable provider, what's going to stop them?
Well, at this point, Al Franken is saying basically nothing is going to stop them. And there are many people who have come to oppose net neutrality because they believe that it's the government takeover of the Internet.
See, didn't you get the memo? Any rule that's passed, any law, that's automatically a government takeover.
You said, I didn't get that memo, it's and
automatic.
I probably should, yeah.
Automatic. Amazing stuff. Victoria Jones, I appreciate your time. Thanks for the report.
Thank you very much.
All righty. Yeah, going back to the comments that I, you know, on the way in here tonight, I was listening to Sean Hannity. He was just all over the place. You know, you got all these liberals, and they want to shut down this vital power because, you know, they want us beholden. It was some bizarre rant that I, you know, you could tell somebody had written out for him. When you stumble over the word "the" like three times, it kind of makes you go, I think you're reading that. But it was interesting in this bizarre rant that he was just reading someone else's opinion. And throwing out facts and figures that no one right off the top of their head would know. And look, nobody's going to really know unless you're an expert in this. What's going on in Japan is a horrible tragedy. We're going to help those people however possible, as we always do. And I agree with him on that. But at the end of this, you know, you're looking at almost a nine earthquake. I don't know much that's going to stand in the wake of that. But what I found interesting, really, is that he went into how much the Japanese spent in planning and how much how much upkeep and how much oversight and how much, you know, they really regulated the industry. And I just kind of, you know, shook my head and go, well, I can't imagine how you would fight all of those things that you now find great about what the Japanese did, how much you would fight that here. Just kind of one of those things. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break right back after this.
America for the better. Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. 6280 or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachman, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If there's any portion of the program that you missed, right there at the website, you can download our podcast. In fact, I encourage everyone to go to the site and download the latest, greatest podcast. If you want to give us your thoughts, comments, ideas, whatever's on your mind, you can email me again, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. I do appreciate the input. I do. I love me some Bachman. And be honest, I mean, there's part of me that wants to see her run for president because I loves me some crazy. And crazy is what she is. Also, what we're finding out is she's academically challenged. she was at an event this past weekend in New Hampshire. And she said to the folks of New Hampshire what she's doing in New Hampshire. I have no real idea because I don't think she's really running for president. But she said, what I love about New Hampshire and what we have in common is our extreme love for liberty. You're the state where the shot was heard round the world in Lexington and Concord. She was in New Hampshire. So for everyone who got out of fifth grade, raise your hands. That's right, fifth grade. We learned about the battles of Lexington and Concord actually took place in Massachusetts. Correct. Gold star to you, which is kind of weird since, you know, somebody wrote that for her. Now, she quipped about it later saying, well, you know, maybe I won't use Barack Obama's teleprompter anymore. No, maybe you should stop writing your own speeches. Pay somebody. Interestingly enough, one of the people over at Real Clear Politics reported that Bachman also talked about the importance of education. You know, we need to teach our children the facts. You know, I could just see George Bush up there talking about we need the facts. Nothing but the facts, ma'am. Let them draw their own conclusions. Let them get their own conclusions. She said, quote, I don't think that our public schools are necessarily the place where one fixed set of political beliefs should be imposed on students. I think that knowledge, facts, and information should be on the table and let students decide where their beliefs should be. Michelle, it's not a belief. The battles of Lexington and Concord were in Massachusetts. It's not a belief. That's a fact. Every fifth grader knows it. And the funny thing is she has been, how's the best way to put it, history challenged in the past. I mean, she's had a lot of these kind of weird statements. So it kind of makes me, you know, kind of makes me uncomfortable. You know, to think that she could be. Well, I mean, think about it this way. George Bush would look like a genius. If she got in, you know, are you smarter than a Bachman? Probably true. New poll came out. And according to Reuters, more than 4 out of 10 American millionaires say they don't feel rich. You know, a million bucks just isn't what it used to be. You know, I just don't feel, I'm not feeling rich anymore with my millions. Indeed, many would need to have at least 7.5 million in order to feel as if they were truly rich, according to Fidelity Investments. Some 42% of the 1,000 millionaires surveyed by Fidelity said they did not feel wealthy. Respondents had at least 1 million investable assets, including any real estate or retirement accounts. The guy who is the president of the National Financial Company, a unit of Fidelity, said every person in the survey is wealthy, but they are still worried about outliving their assets. The average age of the respondent was 56 years old, with a mean of $3.5 million in investable assets. Investable assets. That's not your mortgage. That's not, you know, your cars. That's not any of that kind of wealth. That's money that you've got in their investments. Interesting. So, you know, I think about it, $1 million. And we were talking about it earlier. What was $1 million in investable assets? I would feel quite rich. You know, I go back, and last week there was a story came out and said that the average person in the country has almost over $500,000 in wealth. And I'm going, really? I know very few people that have that. Most people I know, they're in the debt up to their eyeballs. They may have some money in their 401k. They may have a couple of investment bucks. But they got a mortgage that they're, a lot of folks I know, upside down on. They've got car payments. They got all these things. I'm not seeing this $500,000 average. Maybe I just hang out in the wrong neighborhood. But my neighborhood's not bad. You know, I think I'm not in bad position, but I don't have anywhere near $500,000. Wish I did. And the only thing I can come up with is that, you know, if Brett, my chief engineer here, and I were sitting in a room, and Bill Gates walked in, we'd all be multimillionaires on average. Granted, we'd still be broke. The two of us would still be broke. And when he left, our average would go down considerably. But that's the only thing I can think of, is that, you know, with the top, you know, 5% in this country controlling 55% of the nation's wealth. That's according to Fidelity. The top 5%, according to Fidelity, control more than 55% of this nation's wealth. And you're going to tell me that we're a country that we just can't afford it anymore? Or like Michelle Bachmann says, oh, we're running out of rich people. No. We're consolidating rich people. And they're getting even richer. I mean, you know, I remember when I first started my job. 18 years ago, I started a new job with a trucking company that I'm no longer with. But on the day one, they said, you know what, Rick? You work for us for 30 years, you are going to have $1 million, and you are going to be rich. $1 million is a lot of money. Even looking into the future, $1 million is a lot of money today. And I remember saying, I go, you know, there's no way that the powers to be, the people who run this country, are going to allow a dumb truck driver to have $1 million. Not going to happen. And here we are 18 years later. I got like a buck and a half, $1.75 in my individual retirement account that was supposed to be $1 million after 30. Unless the next 12 years are really, really good, I'm not seeing it. Not seeing it at all. But this is interesting. You know, people think you need to have at least $7.5 million now. Interesting stuff. A couple other stories I wanted to get to real quick. Dennis Kucinich, not very happy about the fact that he's unable to visit Private Bradley Manning. The U.S. soldier accused of leaking the State Department documents to WikiLeaks. There have been a whole bunch of conversation around that. Was he mistreated? Has some of the things that have come out, is it true? P.J. Crowley last week had some interesting things to say about, you know, that it was stupid, it was dumb, we shouldn't be doing that kind of stuff. Well, guess what? P.J. Crowley has retired, evidently, after making those comments. And I guess this is a nice way of saying he's probably been fired. It's a nice way of saying, you know, he's moving on. But I think he's right. On Friday, when Crowley said that the treatment of Manning was counterproductive and stupid, I'm going to go with his gut instinct. And I give him credit for standing his ground and saying, you know what? I'm going to stand my ground, and I'll resign. And good for him. I think that's the right thing to do. Also, John Conyers, Democrat from Michigan, and a guy I've interviewed on this program, decent guy, probably one of the few progressives that I think actually does some decent work. He came out today and told reporters that President Obama should be thanking the Republicans for not having anyone even remotely interesting. He pointed out the fact that Obama has disappointed his Democratic Party wing since taking office. Conyers suggested that Obama might have a hard time into 2012 if Republicans came up with somebody even remotely interesting. And I got to be honest, I can't disagree with the guy. I look at what's going on in Wisconsin and the fact that our president has really not, in my opinion, done enough. I mean, I think he could have, if nothing more than to bring the spotlight there and say, hey, you need to do this the right way, the world's watching. And he didn't. He chose not to. So it's going to be interesting. 2012 is going to be a lot closer than I think most people think. When I was in Wisconsin, I read a guy's piece, and he said, you know, this is going to be the first time in generations where both parties' bases will be energized. And he was predicting record turnouts from both sides. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays itself out. I personally think with all the money that's going to be going into this, especially, you know, the big business community, they think they've got workers on the ropes. They think they've got the country on the ropes. It'll be interesting to see how much they throw at this. A couple other quick stories. Remember last week we talked about the 91-year-old Republican legislator from New Hampshire who said, you know, we need to get rid of defective people. You know, basically, you know, the whole eugenics argument that, you know, these folks with mental disorders or physical handicaps, they're just defective, and we need to figure out a way to get rid of them. And people with mental illness should get a one-way trip to Siberia. Well, he resigned. And, you know, good for him. I'm surprised. Also, former Indiana Senator Evan Bayh, he's going to be a Fox News contributor. So there you go. A little bit of money in his pocket should be interesting to see our centrist Democrat turn into a Republican. Man, you know, you look at this and you just go, really? I guess it is all about the money, isn't it? I guess it is all about how they can fill their pockets. It's just this big swinging door. They never have a hard time finding a job. You know, but folks like you and me, you know, when all these jobs went by the wayside in 2009, 2008, into 2009, into 2010, and we were losing hundreds of thousands of jobs, these were the people who were fighting against extending unemployment, extending health care, having a jobs program that, employed people. You know, governments are about people. They really are. And I think it's something that we need to come to the rationale that, you know, this is about all of us, not just the very small, minute number at the top, the 2% that we handed out all the riches to. And I go back to the story I talked about earlier. The $66 billion Republicans want to cut is exactly the amount of money that we gave away last December to the very wealthy, that we didn't have to. So we wouldn't have to go through all these draconian cuts. We wouldn't have to have all this pain for seniors and children and folks who are disabled. Wouldn't have to go through all this. But we made the choice. We hired people who made the choice to say, you know what, the Rockefellers of the world, the Mellonscapes of the world, the Coors, the Mars, the Waltons, the Teppers, all these the Gates, all these folks who are wildly wealthy, you need more at the expense of these folks over here. And here at the state of Pennsylvania, you got Corbett saying, you know what, corporate America, more for you. How the heck with those kids? And do I really believe that Corbett's that kind of a bad guy? Probably not. But it is his ideology. It is this blind faith to corporate master that somehow they will save us, that they are benevolent, that they care about society, that they're going to do the kind of work that needs to be done. And I'm look around. Has it been done? Are private corporations investing in roads and bridges? No. Are they investing in job programs? Are they hiring people for the betterment of society? No. They're profiting. That's what they do. Anyway, tomorrow we're going to head up to the Pocono Medical Center to be a part of that strike. Also going to talk with Scott Conklin, state representative. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath Buddha sway, imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
In March, we will have another history chat session with Dr. Bill O'Brien in this time slot. And another reminder, we're still working on it, but it's more likely than not, April the 9th, a lecture sponsored by West Virginia Citizen Action Group, Patriots for Peace, and Seneca 2, a lecture